Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana El Bay, and this evening we're going to be dealing with what's our money worth and what should we invest in. What kind of investments should people of African descent be making inside the United States? We're going to deal with what is our money worth, what facts should we know when pulled over by police, what is sovereign citizen, can silver and gold save us, what is the solution to our main investments now? And these are just a few of the things that we're going to deal here with this evening. I want to start off by saying, for those of you who are on your social sites, I've been released from the ban. However, I befriended one person today and attempted to friend another one, and they told me that I would be permanently banned if I befriend somebody that I didn't know, and I can't understand how that's your business. However, I'm going to ask if you send your friend request to Tahaka Amana El Bay. I'll go ahead and grant that. That'll give you access to my wall. We put some fantastic documents up there for you to get. And we are exposing the corruption and the lies and the fraud that's going on inside the United States. Okay? Now, in order to get the free articles that we offer, for those of you who are new and who have never received those free articles, send an email to tahaka53@hotmail.com. And we will send you the 14th Amendment Exposed, Secrets of America, The Commerce Game and How to Play, the U.S. Bankruptcy and the Moors, and other documentation in an attachment. We'll get that right over there to you, okay? Just send that email. Just say, Tahaka, just send me those free articles that you mentioned on your broadcast, and I'll rush that right to you. Send it to tahaka53@hotmail.com. That's tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll rush that right on to you. Now, keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, we got the Moorish Summit coming up again in January, so make sure you mark that on your calendar. We had a wonderful time last time you guys were down here, and we're going to do it again. So make sure that you get down here in the January and so that you all can get the latest on what's going on with our economics and all of this stuff. We'll be right here waiting on you. Also, I want to make mention of the fact and start out with our current situation where we are and dealing with our finances. My position is, as far as your finances is concerned, and it just makes so much sense to me because it is what works for me and many, many other people across the United States is finally getting it right. We go to work day in and day out. A lot of us have good, what we consider to be good jobs. Some of us make $16, $17, $18 an hour, and we're able to get a little overtime, and we think we are living. And but I'm here to tell you there's absolutely no security in a job. The only security that you have in a job is as long as you're able to perform. When you're no longer able to perform, The company simply doesn't need you. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can look at the NFL and the NBA and all of these sports industries where we had perfectly healthy people being signing contracts for exorbitant amounts, and then they get an injury and they're benched, and of course the next thing you know they traded, and finally they're discarded altogether. And that's with any job you get. I mean, you can have a good job, you can be on that 30, 40 years, and all of a sudden they want to fire you. That happened the other day down here, where this guy had been with this company. I think he had been there, what they say, for over 35 years, and all of a sudden the supervisors fired him. Okay, he went home, he got a gun, he come back, he killed the supervisor and took several other people, okay? And so when we look at a situation where we can get in, where we can take the resources that we have from the job that we have and invest in something that we created, that we control, and that we own, that we can generate capital from, and that we can invest our spare time in to the point where we are making more money in our own operation than we are on our job, then that is that will bring more happiness to you for as long as you stay on your job. But if you are just totally dependent on that, and then you got these tentacles that's attached to you, you have your mortgage, we got student loans, and we have invested in depreciating assets. Most of us don't realize when you purchase a brand new automobile or a used automobile, that's a depreciable asset. Because what happens is income has to go out of the house to maintain the vehicle. You got to put tires on it, you got to put oil in it, you got to get service, you got to put gas in it. And so that's all income going out of the house. You see, and if it's not a commercial vehicle tied to a company that you own, that you're using to make money, to put money back in the house, you're operating with a depreciable asset. And that actually is listed as one of the worst assets. But we have, in your average household, they have several cars, you know, three, four cars and a truck, right? I know one gentleman lived down the street from me. This guy had I think he had six cars. He had six cars in a truck, and he had a family of four. But he and his wife were the only one who could drive, and that was quite amazing to me. But anyway, nevertheless, we're going to get down in here, and we're going to look at some things involving investments, and I want y'all to hold your hats, and we'll be ready to go in just a second. Okay, so y'all hold on.
I want to talk to you about being on a merry-go-round. You know, a merry-go-round will go round and round and round and round, and if it doesn't stop, you'll remain in the same position, but in order to get off that merry-go-round, you're going to have to put into some effort. And this is pretty much what happens to us on a regular basis. We get up in the morning, shower, shave, get a little bite to eat, make a beeline to work. We get a lunch break, coffee break, another lunch break, and then at the end of the day, we go home. We do this for 360 days a year, and at the end of the year, we're looking for something different to happen financially, but we don't realize that we're in the same position that we were in the year before because we keep doing the same thing. The definition of insanity is keep doing the same thing over and over, looking for a different result, and of course, no different result is going to happen unless you put forth some effort to get off the merry-go-round. Now, one of the major solutions to the problem is to look at your current situation. If you have a mortgage, if you got credit card debt, if you got student loan, if you got a problem with the Internal Revenue Service, if you would cancel these contracts, if you have a mortgage that gives you whatever, if you're paying $800-$900 a month on the mortgage, if you cancel that, that's $900 a month in your pocket. If you have a student loan, you're paying $500-$600 a month on that, that's $500-$600 a month in your pocket. If you Internal Revenue Service asks you for $10,000 that you owe them, you cancel that contract, that's $10,000 that you don't give them. It's very, very simple math, but if we don't make any effort to get off the merry-go-round, we remain in the same position. I would like to recommend you to go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, and the package is available there now for you to cancel those contracts.
Okay, Moses, let's ride. Let's look at Rich and Poe. And for that, we're going directly to Washington, D.C.
A government-subsidized program that's been around since the Great Depression is now in danger of disappearing. I'm talking about public housing, more commonly known as Section 8. The Obama administration has introduced a proposal that's not being welcomed by advocates for public and affordable housing, and the initiative has partially gone into effect here in Washington, D.C. already. RT correspondent Jahan Hafiz has the story.
The United States of America, land of opportunities, but also a land of two tails, one of cities booming with business and politics, the other of a growing wealth divide. As the Great Recession continues to claim its victims, more Americans are in need of public housing. But public housing, or Section 8 as it's widely known in the U.S., has been drying up over the years. The Housing and Urban Development Agency estimates nearly 60 million people either live in public housing or are on the waiting list for a unit. However, the Obama administration is gearing up to transform the future of public housing.
Let's get Congress out of it. Let's get the federal government out of it. And then let's take this private housing, these 3 million units of housing, and let's privatize it.
Under the Obama administration, PETRA, the Preservation, Enhancement, and Transformation of Rental Assistance Act, would hand over the public housing system to the private sector.
To say that we're going to convert it to private ownership is a way of eventually getting rid of public housing.
Linda Leakes of Empower DC insists it will lead to desperation like this scene played out in Atlanta, Georgia, where 30,000 people scrambled for public housing applications that would only be guaranteed to 2,100 people. The best example of what PETRA would offer public housing is Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. has always been known and perhaps will forever be known as Chocolate City. The demographics here are predominantly African American, and this city was once ridden with drug and gang violence. But now the tables have turned, and where Section 8 and public housing once aided desperately in need communities, corporate buildings and condos now stand.
D.C. has an extreme shortage of housing that's affordable to people who don't have a lot of money.
And it was Adrian Finty, Washington, D.C.'s mayor, who decided private-owned public housing units would service the city's poor better than what the government could offer.
He became the mayor of the elite. He did fundraisers at the mansion of developer friends. For instance, Donatelli has hosted a birthday party fundraiser for him. And then, coincidentally or not, Donatelli received two properties on Georgia Avenue by the Metro, valued at over $1 million for only $1.
This is one of the buildings of Christopher Donatelli of Donatelli Development, a close friend and financial donor of Mayor Fenty. He refused to speak with RT, but told other media outlets this building is for affordable housing. That's if you can afford a studio apartment for more than $1,500 a month.
These are low-income and moderate-income families that are being abused this way. When you look at the wealth divide in D.C., a big part of that is the two cities that exist here.
Two tales, two very different narratives reflecting the future of struggling Americans in peril. Jahan Hafiz, RT, Washington, D.C.
So how did it get to this point in the nation's capital? When did gentrification become a priority? First city with so many in need. Well, here to discuss it with me is Reverend Anthony Evans, the president of the National Black Church Initiative. Reverend, thanks so much for being here.
It's good to be here.
First, I want to get your take on Obama's new plan, on this PETRA plan, which essentially is handing over the public housing to private developers. Do you think this is good, bad?
This is a terrible time to do that. What the government should be doing is what they have been doing in foreclosure. They should look very closely at the housing stock in major cities. They should look at affordable housing, increase in affordable housing, and then begin to do what we call mixed density, Hope 6 and all of that stuff. But what they haven't done up until the time of the foreclosure crisis is adequately fund public housing and adequately had a sufficient amount of stock to take care of those who had moderate income. So it makes no sense.
But the thing is, D.C.'s public housing system has also come under a lot of criticism. It's one that's been riddled with violence. I think it was ranked the second worst in the country. You know, in the past, it's also been placed under receivership. So clearly there are problems here. This is not a perfect system. So is throwing more money at it the best idea? Perhaps could, part public, part private ownership help it?
Well, that has never been the case. The case has been, of course, is that we have never had a situation where we had what we call mixed density, where there are middle-class whites and middle-class blacks and lower-class blacks and lower-class whites live in the same apartment complex. That has never existed on a mass scale. They have done some experimental stuff in Chicago and other cities. But what has taken place in the district has been just criminal. Between the election of Anthony Williams, our former mayor, and Mayor Fentick, they have literally given the store away. So no wonder there's no affordable housing, simply because even though we have a form of rent control in the city, it still hasn't helped those who have moderate income and is on a fixed budget. So in other words, he never allowed the poor to catch up to the housing. In this city, you spend 60% of your income on housing. That's outrageous.
I will agree with you. The prices in this city are completely outrageous. I was shocked when I first moved here from Los Angeles, which is not a cheap place in itself. I didn't know what was in store for me when coming to D.C. But still, you know, about my question, the fact that they say this is the second worst in the nation, the system here, is that because enough money wasn't sent to it? Or why is it? Why was it so bad?
It's a continuous story of how the District of Columbia and other governments have ran public housing poorly. And they have ran it poorly because they have never, it is not because they have not gotten enough money. That has never been the case. Creativity, listening to those who are in need, doing different ventures in housing, and NCRC and Neighborhood Works is two perfect national nonprofits who have given public housing people around the country new ideas who have failed to implement them. And so when the developer came calling and said that I'm going to make this a very beautiful place and make 2 out of 300 apartments on low income, a moderately income, that's not public housing. That's giving the store away. Anthony Williams did it, and Mr. Fenty is doing it, and other big cities mayor is doing it, just to deal with the issue of blight in the city. So let's be honest what the real deal is here.
Well, it sounds like a lot of mismanagement. But tell me this, you know, because everyone is suffering right now around the country. I mean, the country is in a recession. You know, some are saying we're heading towards a depression. But when you look at the figures, D.C. in itself as a city is actually booming. This is where people can get work right now. But that's because there are two different Washington, D.C. So how does it make you feel that, you know, statistically, if other people are listening, they think that Washington doesn't understand them and Washington doesn't feel the same crisis?
Well, Washington does. I mean, and this is a case of racial underpinning. Any big city mayor, even Marion Barry, failed to do this. It brings those two Washingtons together. Mary had a wonderful opportunity during his reign as mayor of the District of Columbia to do that. He failed to do it because Marion understood that the big city business interests did not want to make that happen. Washington could have the best housing stock in the country over the past 20 years. Right now, Washington have gone through two booms. We went to a boom right after Marion Barry under Anthony Williams, and then we went to a small boom under Mr. Fenty. But prior to that, they had 30,000 people with Section 8 looking for housing. And so it was no way that those who were looking for housing for Section 8 money prior to Washington revitalization. And revitalization really would mean is that the whites who could afford to live in the city and pay market rates moved into the city, which drove up prices. So that's really was the real
boom
here.
Well, my question is very quickly. I have two questions, actually, because we only have 1 minute left. Where will these people go, these residents of Washington that won't have public housing? And also, you know, do you predict that it's going to get so bad that we'll see a scene like we saw in Atlanta, where 30,000 people were out in the streets just to get on a waiting list?
Absolutely. And this area, they're going to go two places. They're going to go to Northern Virginia, which they don't want them in Northern Virginia, and they're going to go to Prince George's County. And Prince George's County has been absolving Washington, D.C. poor for the past 10 years. So are we going to have a crisis like it takes place in East Point, Atlanta? Absolutely. And we're going to have a crisis in other major American cities, simply because big city mayors will not face down developers and make sure that everything is equal. You cannot have a city of rich and haves. You've got to have a complete diversification.
Unfortunately,
of the city.
We have an entire country
of
the rich and the haves and the have-nots. Yeah. And, you know, it's playing out here in D.C. So, Reverend, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Moses, we're back. That is kind of bad situation there. I was remember back in the 70s, an article came out of the Worldwide Church of God that says we must prepare to greatly reduce our standard of living for what's coming in the future here inside the United States. And since that day, I've been watching this thing very, very closely, and I've always been trying to make sure that I encourage the brothers and sisters to start to tighten up economically. Prepare yourself. Everything that it will take for you to survive, you have to prepare. You have to have a plan. You cannot continue to think that by some hook or crook or keep looking at the politicians inside the United States that somebody is going to do something. And year after year, nothing happens. The situation remains the same, and it gets a little bit worse as each year go by. So in order for us to survive, we have to do something. We're going to have to take responsibility for the fact that we're going to have to reduce our standard of living. We're going to have to prepare for any type of economic fallout that may come our way. And what we're going to do here this evening is we're going to deal with some solutions to the best investment that any of us can make toward our future. It's very, very important. The number one investment that we're going to have, that we're going to need, is we're going to need education. Now, when I say education, I'm talking about specialized education. In the investments that you're going to invest in, that's going to contribute to your survival coming up in the near future. Now, we're going to open up lines after the first hour. And for those of you who have comments and questions, you go ahead and raise your hand. In order to contact me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, directly, you can call me at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I'll do my best to try to help you with whatever problems that you may have. Now, for those of you who have problems with the mortgage, if you're receiving threatening letters, now's the time to contact me in regards to that, 904-303-9061. And you can also visit www.newfreehelpgroup.com, and we have a way for you to remedy that situation. Okay? Now, we're going to take a quick glimpse at something here, and we're going to come right back.
I'm Will Allen. I'm an agriculturalist in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I'm the CEO of Growing Power, which is a nonprofit organization here in Milwaukee, and our mission is to support community food systems locally, regionally, nationally, and now we do work internationally as well. 5 million people die a year worldwide because of poor water and lack of food. It's happening here in our inner cities where people, you go to corner stores because there are no grocery stores, and in corner stores all you have is processed food. It's my belief that everybody, regardless of their economic means, should have access to the same healthy, safe, affordable food that's grown naturally. Well, a community food center is what we've developed here. That's a place where people can come for trainings to learn how to grow food, how to grow soil, how to grow energy. That's what we do here at Growing Power. And kids are the most powerful inspiration because you can see it in their faces. They show it in so many different ways that you appreciate what you do. And that's what drives me. And it's the future of our food system. If we want healthy local food, our new generation of farmers are going to come. They're not going to come from rural communities. They're not going to come from traditional farm families, because those things don't exist in our system anymore. These new farmers are going to come from folks that live in the city. What you see in these greenhouses is about relationship building. I don't build gardens with fences. Everybody's talking about, oh, we got to put up a fence to protect our garden. No. You have to engage the community. We go into communities and we organize around the work that we do, which is food. It's a very powerful organizing tool. I didn't start doing this work to get awards. I don't do this work to get awards. I think it'll benefit our organization in terms of organization can leverage the publicity that we'll get from this award to help us do more of our work. You know, I think that, to me, that's very important.
Okay, that's Mr. Will Allen up in Wisconsin, and he is dealing with one of the major solutions that we need to consider for investment. Right here in Jacksonville, Florida, we have Eastside Farms, and on this farm we are growing all organic fruits and vegetables. And this is something, because if you look at it, it's a major investment, and it has tremendous profit potential. Because if you go in any grocery store in the United States, all you have to do is look at the fruits and vegetables section. And in the fruits and vegetables section, read the labels on the packaging, and you'll discover that this stuff is being imported from other countries. You got it coming in from Argentina. You got it coming in from Guatemala. You got it coming in from China, Japan. And these stores are paying exorbitant prices and a ton of money to get this stuff transported from one country to another. And we have no idea what type of pesticides these people are using on these plants, and we're steady buying it and consuming it. But when you grow something, you know what you're putting in it. You know what kind of seeds you're using. You know whether you're using any kind of pest, anything you put on it, you know what you're doing. And so if you use your imagination and realize you get enough gardening going, you got stores that'll be willing to purchase organic fruits and vegetables direct from you locally. That saves them on transportation costs. That saves them on storage costs. That provides them a measure of safety for human consumption and all these things. And we've got people in the United States that are actually doing this, and stores are contacting these people, and restaurants are coming to these people's shelves out of these restaurants, are coming to them and knocking on their door, getting all of their vegetation from these people, and they're growing this food right in their yard. Imagine that. And it's going on right now in the United States. That is a major investment. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have to invest in other things, but I just wanted to put that out there as a major investment, because inside the United States, if you look at the agricultural base that we had years ago is almost non-existent today. But here's an opportunity for you to invest your money into something that's not only going to cause you and your family to survive, but also could very well give you a healthy income and contribute to the uplifting of your city or your state.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one. Bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Silver is way below its equilibrium price. From my analysis, the equilibrium price right now for silver is almost $16. And as the buying interest increases, that equilibrium price moves up. So the price, real price, actually tries to chase it. So from that point of view, silver is ready to move better and stronger than gold. It's just having a bit of a headwind right now. Once it overcomes that, I think we'll see silver outperform gold quite dramatically.
Now, in regards to that and the little hang-up that silver has right now, according to your analysis, do you think silver is going to look a lot better, as per your analysis, before gold breaks through 1,000, or might it continue to lag just a bit until we get that major breakout in gold?
I would say that it will probably start to outperform gold before gold goes for 1,000. I think this bit of headwind is only very short term. It may be over by the end of next week. So I don't see it being a major lag on silver for very long.
And just to reiterate, you're looking for a even more explosive move in silver once we get these breakouts in the entire sector.
Absolutely. In silver, you know, as you probably know, I mean, there's very little left on the planet. The U.S. Geological Society said just a couple of years ago that silver would be the first element in the periodic table that would become extinct. And that news almost got buried on probably page 20 of the Wall Street Journal. You know, that's incredibly bullish. They said that would happen by 2020. You know, if we're in the situation where we can run out of silver, the price clearly has to go up, because we can't obviously run out of silver. What will happen is the price will have to go to a price level where it's economic to recycle it. We recycle almost all the gold we use in any industrial application, but we throw silver away in our cell phone batteries and solder connections, this sort of thing, in landfills. So the price has to go to a price probably close to the price of gold right now for it to be economic to not throw another gram of silver away in a landfill. We don't throw any gold away. So I see silver probably eventually reaching a price which is higher than gold, based on the fact that it's more rare than gold right now because we've consumed it.
Oh, that's very interesting. You think that the silver-gold ratio then could presumably, I guess the historical average I think is 14 if I remember correctly. So you think that it could actually, in that case, then it would go below 1?
Yeah, many analysts you know, keep the same sort of ratios that we had in the past, forgetting that we're consuming silver, and it's irretrievable. It's not going to ever be recycled from landfills. So the traditional ratio that you find in the Earth's crust is fine while there's still plenty of it around. But as it starts to become extinct, then silver becomes very rare and will become more rare than gold. It's difficult for us to get our minds around it right now, but that's what's going to happen. If you look what happened to rhodium, two years ago, it went from $300 to $10,000 an ounce. And most people probably don't even know that. It certainly didn't get on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. But you know, that was a move that could be made in the metal and didn't even make any news. You know, silver could do something that's a lot more dramatic.
Yeah, certainly. You know, we know that, you know, assuming gold makes this breakthrough 1,000, that it's likely to have quite a parabolic run, but everyone would agree that silver would probably do the same, and then it just becomes very difficult to know when it's going to end, when it's going to peak. And I would throw in that news tidbit you mentioned a few minutes ago from the Geologic Survey about silver extinction. It doesn't exactly sound like an extremely negative piece of fundamental news, I would say.
Right. And the... You know, gold almost has no industrial applications. This is what the bears throw at us that is negative about gold, apparently, is that it has no use. Well, it has no use which consumes it. Its use, its sole use, essentially, is to store value. And that's what it does perfectly. And it obviously does it very well because we still have pretty much all the gold that's ever been mined in history still above ground somewhere. So it's perfectly stored wealth for 6,000 years and has never been consumed. So this notion that there's something negative about gold because it has no industrial use is rubbish. It has one use, which is to store value, which is why governments hate it so much, because if gold is going up, there is only one reason why it's going up, and that's because people are using it to store value. Any other commodity which has more than one use, like silver, like copper, like oil, you can always point to, oh, it's the economy is recovering, that's why the that commodity is going up. But gold you can't make excuses for, so that's why the price is suppressed. Silver does have industrial uses, and it competes with its use as a store of value. And the industrial use has been so big compared to investment demand that it's the industrial application which has suppressed the price. You imagine if you wanted to invest in bread, you wouldn't stand much chance of its price going up because people keep making as much bread as people ask for. And that's been the case with silver for a long time, except that it's drawn down most of the accumulated stocks. Now we're getting to the point where the investment demand and the industrial demand is in competition and it will drive the price to very high levels. And we can't live without silver. At the limit, you could say, well, if gold disappeared from the planet tomorrow, life would still go on. If that was the case with silver, life would not go on. Most of the technology that we use today would just cease to exist.
Yes, well, I'm sure that, who knows, maybe in 5 years people will be selling and recycling their forks and their knives and spoons, given the economic situation and how high the price of silver might go. Now, I just want to get some final thoughts on the precious metals bull market. And I asked this to Bill Murphy during that interview. Now, some analysts I talk to, they see this being this run that we've presumably started, they see it lasting maybe 2 to 3 years in a huge spike, and Bill Murphy said he thinks it could go on for 5 to 8 years. Where do you fit in that camp? And also, do you think this bull market is going to end with some kind of a hard money standard or something else, namely really high interest rates?
Yes, I think going on for a long time, mainly because this is not just a story about gold and silver. This is actually a story about the breakdown of the financial system, global financial system, the breakdown of currencies, and the breakdown of this scam that of fiat currencies. So that is what is making real things, commodities, in particular gold and silver, to now increase in value with respect to those fiat currencies. And because that is systemic, this will last a long time. And it will last until there is a fix for that systemic problem. So, yes, what you mentioned there, the fix will eventually have to be some sort of hard money, some sort of backing of the currencies. And I can't see that happening for many years until politicians are really forced into that situation as a last resort. They'll try everything under the sun to avoid that before they go to a hard money system. So this will be a bull market that goes on a long time. As for interest rates, under the current structure, I can't see that can be a solution. If they were to raise interest rates like Volcker did to 21% to kill the commodity rallies, then we would do a lot of damage to the world economy. So I don't think that's a solution this time around. There's far too much leverage in the system compared to when Volcker did that. and the system just cannot take it.
Okay, Morris, we're back. Well, that gives us a glimpse of the silver and gold markets and what's coming with that. However, there is nothing wrong with investing your cash, because we know that's worthless, into rare gold and silver coins. And but you want to make sure that your primary investment is in life-sustaining systems, something that's going to cause you life, that you can live until such times is we have a better economy or whatever. We have something that we can feed our family with in our waters to drink. So that's just the bottom line. That's, to me, that's the number one investment that should be everybody should start considering at this particular point in time. Now let's take a look at our position as people of African descent, or Moors, or people as labeled as Negro, colored, and black inside the United States. Where are we now?
Hi everyone, I'm Carl Azus, and this is CNN Student News. Thank you for taking a vacation from your vacation to check out our latest summer webcast. Today we are focusing on a sensitive and sometimes controversial topic. It's also part of our country's history, from slavery to the civil rights movement. 40 years after Dr. Martin Luther King's death, CNN has launched Black in America. This is a huge project that examines stereotypes and statistics and asks what it means to be black in America today. These special reports investigate health issues like the devastating toll of HIV and AIDS on the African American community. They also explore the progress of black men and women in the professional world and the black middle class. One of the biggest topics that Black in America addresses is education and the disparities between black and white students. Soledad O'Brien visited a school in New York that's working to close that gap.
Principal Elijah Hawks of the James Baldwin School in New York City says his school has something most principals only dream about, a 94% graduation rate.
The only way one can do this work and do it well is if you believe that a student failing in your class is your responsibility.
It's a new public school made up mostly of transfer students and paid for with taxpayer money. The classes are very small, just 17 seniors last year. But what's most surprising, many of the students were failing out before coming here.
How bad were your grades?
That'd be tough.
Really?
Yeah.
So you came here as a failing student.
Mm-hmm.
What are your grades now?
It's like B minus.
Your graduation rate is significantly higher than the average graduation rate in a New York City public school, with far fewer students, I'll give you, but much higher.
Having your voice heard can equate to passing a class.
Almost half the students are African American. A Harvard University study shows black children start falling behind academically by age 3. A separate Harvard study found in urban areas the average black student performs on a level about 4 years below his peers. Over 1 million students attend New York City public schools. About 3/4 are minorities, 70% are impoverished.
For as long as anyone can remember in America, our African American and Latino students are way underperforming white and Asian students.
Schools like Baldwin are fighting to change that.
I just thought if I was guided the right way, then I would succeed.
The school's success proves size matters.
Small schools are just where it's at, where you can sort of like delve into like what a student is and who that student is and what they're about, and I think that that's our core.
I have teachers on my butt, and I like that because I never was used to that, and they helped me change to a better person, like, and got me focused.
They realize that we value that they're individuals, and for many of them, that's a catalyst for their success here.
They're also helped by mandatory week-long camping trips, where students work to overcome challenges.
There's a lot of pushing and cajoling that leads up to students taking that trip and taking that leap of faith, and it's transformative for so many of them.
So transformative that a once failing student is now planning for college.
I grew up a screw up, so I'm gonna change the pattern. Like I'm gonna do something for myself and go to school and make something out of my life.
Baldwin isn't the end for these students. Baldwin is a step in the course of their academic career.
Beating the odds, by focusing on individual needs. Soledad O'Brien, CNN, New York.
Is this legit? One student drops out of high school every minute. Well, this one's false. It's actually much worse. According to America's Promise Alliance, one American student drops out every 26 seconds.
That adds up to more than a million dropouts a year. Only 70% of all high school students graduate in 4 years. That number drops to 50% for black students. Susan Rosegen reports on a charter school in Chicago that's trying to break that statistic by providing a safe place to learn in a tough part of town.
We believe in ourselves. We believe in each other. We believe in our pride. We believe.
They're chanting, "We believe." But who are they?
I had a real bad attitude towards, like, everybody. I didn't want to talk. I didn't want to do work. It was just hard, and I didn't want to be here.
The odds were never good for 16-year-old D'Angelo Gardner. His father died of a heroin overdose when D'Angelo was 9, and by the 8th grade, he was caught up in a gang. D'Angelo was also part of a dire demographic. In Chicago, young black men had the highest school dropout rates. 50%, half of them, will drop out of high school. Only 3% will finish college. And that's not all. So far this year, nearly 30 Chicago public school students have been shot to death. In impoverished neighborhoods like Inglewood, guns and gangs are a part of daily life. But Urban Prep Academy is a safe haven.
We understand.
This is a school for young black men, a glimmer of hope to get them off the streets and into the classroom.
Question mark.
D'Angelo's mother did all she could to get him into Urban Prep. It's a charter school. He and his fellow freshmen entered the school with a 6th grade reading level. 2 years later, they've improved dramatically. D'Angelo says he used to be allergic to homework. Not anymore.
I still have to get my study habits up, but I touch books now.
This is actually another very, very good car.
Teacher Trey Childress has been at the school since day one. He says at first, D'Angelo and his classmates did not have the skills to think critically.
They kind of just wanted to be, you know, sit there and be spoon-fed. Now they want to actively be engaged in discussions. They want to debate each other. And they're really, like I said, performing at a high level as far as their own cognitive abilities.
And it's not just academics the students have embraced. They've also accepted their teachers as role models. Sophomore Marlon Marshall knows he's not alone here.
When they see I'm not working to the best of my ability, they pull me to the side or they give me extra work and say, this is the level you need to be working on because this is where I see your ability at.
As in many Chicago public schools, 90% of Urban Prep students come from single-parent, female-headed households.
It's always great when they'll say, you know, my young man was doing this and I was, you know, pulling my hair out and now he's helping out around the house, you know, helping out with his little brothers and sisters. He's a little bit, you know, he's more responsible, and that makes you feel really good that now they're living our creed at home and in the community. That definitely makes our chest stick out a little bit more.
As D'Angelo has changed, he hopes to inspire some of his old friends.
I tell them straight up, like, You have to do something else, not just hang in the neighborhood all the time. There's other things out here.
And Marlon says when you hear opportunity knocking, let it in. He refuses to be a stereotype.
Young black men cannot graduate from high school or go to college. Young black men are better off in jail. They fall under that statistic because they don't have a motivational push to stop them from doing whatever the things they are doing to get them into that status.
And motivation is just what they get at Urban Prep.
We believe in each other. We believe in Urban Prep. We believe.
Susan Rosegen, CNN, Chicago.
If you missed the most recent Black in America specials, The Black Woman and Family, and The Black Man, we will be re-airing those programs. Go to CNN.com/Black in America for air dates and times. While you're there, check out our discussion guide. It has questions and activities that parents can use to help young people understand the issues facing black America.
Being black in America, it just means being beautiful, embracing oneself, loving oneself, and just being true to yourself.
It means being able to overcome adversity.
Holding yourself at a higher standard.
we are a part of a minority group in the United States of America. That means we have to work harder, fight harder, and actually hold ourselves at a higher standard and treat ourselves with respect in order to move forward.
It's like a famous quote goes, being a spectator at your own leisure. Not to say that it's all negative, but honestly, being black in America, you have to locate a pride within yourself that stems from struggle. And that pride can then lead to power, which can then lead to revolution.
I think it's time for us as a country to unite and stop talking about black America and white America and become an American, a country of one.
All right, some thoughts there from students at HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. Earlier this year, CNN traveled to some of the country's most well-known HBCUs and held a campus iReporter contest. Participants were challenged to create their own videos about what it means to be black in America. The winning entry came from Travers Johnson, a senior at Morehouse College. His iReport examined whether it's a good time to be young and black in America. You can find his video in the Spotlight section on our homepage, and head to our blog to share your thoughts on today's program, which has reached its end. We've got one more summer webcast to go. We will see you then from CNNStudentNews.com.
There's an old saying that you do not wait for war to make ammunition. Ammunition is to be made in peacetime. And the same thing is happening with those of you who have contracts with banks and mortgage companies on a mortgage. When everything is going fine and that money is going out, and you think because you have a good job you might be making 15, 20 bucks an hour and everything is fine, but what we have to understand is there is absolutely no security in a job. The only security that you have in a job is as long as you are able to perform. If you don't believe that, look at injured players of the NBA and the ABA and the NFL. What you have to do is engage yourself in the process of diversity. You have to diversify not only your income, but you have to diversify your situation. In a time of peace and the mortgage company is not foreclosing on you, maybe just sending you threatening letters, you're having some technical difficulties, now's the time to cancel the contract. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Let's take a look at the worth of our money now. Let's see where we are as far as the worth. What is the value of our money? Because most of us, I won't say most of us, but there are people inside the United States that think if they have $10, they got $10. But you have to look at it realistically. What you need to look at is if you have a $10 bill, how much actual hard purchasing power does that $10 bring? And so you take a $10 bill, you go in the store, you buy $10 worth of items. When you come back, you take out a calendar, or you take out a historical a landmark situation device, a record, and go back in time and look at the price, how much you were able to purchase with that $10, we'll say 5 years ago. Then go back 5 more years. Then go back 5 more years. And then go back another 5 years. You'll discover that the $10 that you have in your possession has depreciated in actual purchasing power. So you don't really have $10. So we have, let's say, back in the 70s, the dollar was worth about 30 cents in actual purchasing power. And I'm pretty sure now it's probably down. I heard recently it's worth 2 cents. $1 is actually worth 2 cents, 2 pennies in actual purchasing power compared to several years ago when it was not like that. So what we're going to look at now is let's look at the worth of our money. We're going to run a quick short clip on that and take a look at that, okay?
You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. 6 feet, don't you call me, cause I can't go, I owe my soul to the company store.
What gives our money value? In the past, our money was backed by gold or silver. Of course, paper money is more convenient to carry than gold or silver, so gold and silver certificates were issued, redeemable for gold and silver coin in the appropriate denomination. Today, our money isn't backed by gold or silver. It isn't backed by anything. It's printed at the whim of the government and the Federal Reserve, which is why the dollar has gone down in value. The only thing that gives our money value today is how much of it is in circulation. The more money we have in circulation, the less the dollar is worth. This is also known as inflation. This is why we can no longer go to the general store and buy flour or sugar for 3 cents a pound. Just a few decades ago, our coins had silver content, giving the coin itself value, melt value, as well as legal tender value. Today, our coins are made mostly of zinc, copper, and nickel. This means that their melt value is generally much less than their legal tender value. The good news is that zinc, copper, and nickel do have a higher value than paper. If American currency were to become worthless today, paper money wouldn't be worth a dime, regardless of its denomination. Coins, on the other hand, would be worth the value of its metal content. Unfortunately, because we don't use gold or silver to mint coins anymore, most of our coins are worth less than face value. In today's trying times, you should know how much your money is worth. The following values are the melt value of our common coinage based on the market values as of October 3, 2008. Pennies that were minted between 1982 and 2008 are worth less than a half a cent in melt value. 100 of today's pennies have a melt value of 42 cents. Pennies that were minted between 1909 and 1981 are 95% copper, giving them a higher melt rate. In fact, they are worth almost 2 cents apiece. 100 of these pennies have a melt value of $1.79. Today's nickels are worth a little more than 4 cents apiece. A dollar's worth of nickels, or 20 nickels, have a melt value of 82 cents. Nickels made between 1942 and 1945 have a 35% silver content, making their value higher. One nickel is worth about 63 cents, or 20 for $12.65. Today's dimes are worth about a penny and a half apiece. 10 dimes, a dollar in legal tender value, have a melt value of just 15 cents. Dimes made between 1916 and 1964 were 90% silver and are worth 81 cents apiece. 10 of these dimes have a current melt value of $8.13. Today's quarters are a copper-nickel alloy. They are worth a little less than 4 cents each. 4 of these, a legal tender dollar, have a melt value of about 15 cents. Quarters made between 1932 and 1964 were 90% silver and are worth about $2 apiece, or 4 for $8.14. The modern half dollar has a melt value of less than 8 cents. 2 of these are worth about 15 cents. Half dollars minted between 1965 and 1970 were a silver-copper alloy and have a melt value of about $1.66. 2 are worth about $3.32. Half dollars made between 1916 and 1964 are 90% silver and have a melt value of over $4 each, or 2 for $8.13. The modern dollar coin, the presidential dollar and the Sacagawea dollar, are worth less than 5 cents apiece. Susan B. Anthony dollars are worth about 5.5 cents. Some Eisenhower dollars of the 1970s were made of a copper-nickel alloy, and some were made of a copper-silver alloy. The copper-nickel dollars have a melt value of about 15 cents apiece, but the copper-silver dollars are worth about $3.50 each. Silver dollars minted between 1878 and 1935 have a 90% silver content, making them worth $8.70 each. So now you know what your money is really worth. Maybe it's not such a good idea to cash in that change jar. Your change is definitely worth more than your paper money, and your credit cards have a melt value equivalent to that of a soda bottle, minus the soda.
That's kind of rough. Needless to say, that's where we are. And these statistics were in 2008. It's 2013, so we know that things have gotten much, much worse. Okay? So I'm bringing this information out so that we can consider what actions to take in the future involving the currency and our current living conditions, because I see a lot of people, they're going to and fro, and nothing has changed. I mean, we're just constantly moving. We're constantly doing the same thing. We're filling the restaurants. We're investing in our suits. We're going to the church, filling up the collection plates. We just keep going round and round and round on the same merry-go-round, as if the overall condition that we are surrounded by are just simply not happening.
What is Agenda 21? The constitutionalist movement has heard vague echoes in recent years about a threat to the free economy from this Agenda 21. Well, Agenda 21 is not new. The New American Magazine and its affiliate, the John Birch Society, were one of the few constitutionalist organizations that was present when it was drawn up back at the 1992 Earth Summit on Climate Change in Rio de Janeiro. The summit, organized by the United Nations, brought together the most extreme environmental activists from around the world to deal with the supposed threat from global warming. And Agenda 21 was the document they drew up. The New American's William F. Jasper attended the conference as a reporter and was able to report on events at the Rio summit as they happened. And he's been reporting on them for some 20 years ever since, including the Wildlands Project, which would take most of America outside of the habitable zone for human beings in order to make room for the animals. What came out of this Rio summit in 1992 was summed up by the radical environmentalists themselves. And one United Nations-approved introduction to the Agenda 21 document claimed that, quote, effective execution of Agenda 21 will require a profound reorientation of all human society, unlike anything the world has ever experienced. A major shift in the priorities of both government and individuals, and an unprecedented redeployment of human and financial resources. This shift will demand that a concern for the environmental consequences of every human action to be integrated into individual and collective decision-making at every level. The document leaves no one alone, stating, quote, there are specific actions which are intended to be undertaken by, in short, every person on Earth. What it means for Americans is more than just an end to fossil fuels. It means a lower standard of living. And the strategy for implementing Agenda 21 was a much broader strategy than ever attempted by the environmentalist movement. They sought global treaties and national legislation, as in the past. They also sought to shame individuals and corporations into changing their behavior on a voluntary basis. That, too, was not new. But they also began fighting for what's called soft law changes to consumers' living standards. Soft law is the use of centralized governments to bribe with aid or regulations either smaller governmental subunits, such as states and localities, or private companies for following ever more stringent eco-standards with tax breaks or outright cash aid. On the state and local level, the push for soft law is led by the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives, or ICLEI, which had been founded a couple of years before the Rio summit. More than 1,000 state, county, and municipal government organizations around the world are ICLEI members and are pushing this radical environmentalist agenda with bribes and stiffer regulations. In many American towns, local officials boast about the impact of ICLEI in the form of putting state rebate checks on display for properly following new environmentalist incentives. For example, John Birch Society New England Regional Director Hal Shurtleff was able to point out that
here is what's disturbing. Here is a check made out to the city of Newburyport from Massachusetts Executive Office of Energy and Environmental Affairs. And why is this check on display? Well, this is the second such check that I have found in a city or town that belongs to the ICLEI, International Council on Local Environmental Initiative, which is a government-to-government entity, unconstitutional on its face, and their goal is to implement Agenda 21, what they call soft law, that came out of the Rio Conference in 1992. Very hostile to property rights, freedoms, and any town or city official who thinks somehow being part of this is going to help the communities is gravely mistaken.
ICLEI has become a big part of the subsidy and regulation regime on the state and local level, but it's not the only part of the eco-subsidy agenda. That also extends to the White House, where President Obama has called for government to start picking winners and losers in the markets for more energy-efficient products. President Obama boasted in his May 6, 2011 weekly address that,
"But over the long term, the only way we can avoid being held hostage to the ups and downs of oil prices is if we reduce our dependence on oil. That means investing in clean, alternative sources of energy, like advanced biofuels and natural gas. And that means making cars and trucks and buses that use less oil. Other countries know this, and they're going all in to invest in clean energy technologies and clean energy jobs."
This is part of the reason why huge corporations such as General Electric were able to claim a $3.25 billion tax credit in 2010, paying no corporate income taxes that year. GE cashed in on federal tax credits for green projects, such as its wind turbine project. Of course, nobody objects to private companies offering more fuel-efficient automobiles or creating products that don't fill up landfills. The problem with ICLEI and Agenda 21 is that they primarily seek governments to pick the winners and the losers in the marketplace. Governments usually pick the wrong winners. That was the lesson from the housing bubble of the last decade. The federal government promoted home ownership by subsidies, tax credits, and suppression of interest rates, and crashed the whole economy. Government doing the same thing on green jobs will do the same thing to the economy on a much larger scale.
Okay, Morris, we're back. That's Agenda 21. And I want to bring that out so we can become familiar with us with that. I know a lot of you have already examined that in the past, but I want to reiterate that here so that we can keep in mind that this thing has not gone away, and we do need to pay attention to what's out there. Now, I want to deal with one other thing here that we need to consider when it comes to our survival in the economic situation inside the United States, because these things are looming.
In the autumn of 2011, a phenomenon, a grassroots movement that we all know as Occupy Wall Street, became the growing face and voice of America. But at the start of 2011, there was one man that predicted a movement such as Occupy Wall Street would be sweeping through the United States. And that man is my current guest here to speak with RT, Gerald Salenti, founder of the Trends Research Institute and publisher of the Trends Journal. Thank you for sitting down to speak with me again.
Thank you.
What do you think will happen with Occupy Wall Street in 2012?
Occupy Wall Street's gone global. You know how people keep looking to America for something to happen here, and then the rest of the world kind of latches onto it? Even though you think that American spirit is dead, the whole world kind of focuses on the United States for the center of some kind of social, economic, geopolitical, or cultural change. And Occupy Wall Street was just that. It inspired an Occupy movement worldwide. We call it the invasion of the Octopi, like tentacles reaching out all over the globe. When you cut one off, another one grows. It's an estimated 80 countries in 112 cities. There's no stopping it. And by the way, the very police brutality that tried to stop the Octopi movement in Wall Street is what brought it to the forefront. The movement is not going to stop. Winter's set in. Things are quiet now. The governments around the world do not know how to control the octopi.
All the events of police brutality against Occupy Wall Street activists took place before the National Defense Authorization Act was signed by President Obama. What can happen now to all the Americans that speak out against the way that their elected officials are governing the country?
One of our top 12 trends for 2012 is Battlefield America. It's going to be the will of the people against the will of the government. The Senate of the United States and the House of Representatives, the gang of 535, and deciding like this guy Lindsey Graham, the cracker from South Carolina, calling America a battlefield and saying that if you're accused of being tied into a terrorist organization or you're a belligerent, as the way the act is now written, you have no judge, you have no jury, you have no trial, you don't have charges filed against you. The military could come in and take someone like me that they may call a belligerent because they don't like what I have to say, and they could take me away, lock me up in detention, blow my brains out. No lawyer, no habeas corpus. It's the Bill of No Rights signed by President Obama. And what it does, it also allows the military to take somebody like me or someone they don't like, who they choose, who the Gestapo chooses to be called an anti-American or working with a terrorist group. I may give money to a group that they don't like, and they could tie that back to me.
You have forecasted a trend involving what you believe will be economic martial law being implemented in the U.S. What exactly do you mean by that?
The entire financial system is collapsing. It's a worldwide financial meltdown. We can see the collapse of the European Union. It's happening in front of us. There's no way of bailing them out. Just the G7 has $7.5 trillion worth of debt coming due in 2012. How are they going to pay that off? As it collapses, look what's going on around the world. Look what's going on in Greece. It's a depression. It's a depression in Spain. It's a depression in Portugal. It's going to be a depression in Italy, a recession in France. It's collapsing around the world. You look at the housing market now starting to unravel, the bubble being burst in China. It's happening everywhere. So what we're saying is they're not going to be able to keep this afloat. We're going to see something smack down really hard, probably coming from the Europeans. When that happens, the United States will blame them. As they see those Europeans, it's them socialists. And now, unfortunately, we have to call a bank holiday because of the problems that they caused. Or a false flag, a terrorist strike, or war, which is another option going on very close to us as the Iranian conflict's building. They will give an excuse to call a bank holiday in America. You don't get your money yet. They closed down the banks. Go back to 9/11. They closed down Wall Street. If you had certificates of deposit like I did and tried to get them out, I couldn't get them out. That's right, my money was frozen. I had a lot of money. You see what happened to people when Argentina called a bank holiday back in 2001, 2002. People that had money in the bank account to buy a house, by the time the bank holiday was over, that money couldn't buy a car. That's right, they devalue the currency.
You brought up Iran. What are the major concerns right now when it comes to Iran and the possibility of a war?
The United States, again, with the National Defense Authorization Act, part of that was that President Obama effectively has declared war against Iran. The latest legislation puts sanctions on foreign companies dealing with Iranian banks. They're effectively putting an embargo on Iran. It's an act of war. Go back to World War II. It's like when the United States stopped Japan from being able to buy oil. Now the Iranians can't sell it. If they lose just 20% of their ability to sell oil, you're looking at 60% of their GDP comes from oil sales. You're putting them out of business. If the United States, Israel, or NATO attacks Iran's nuclear facilities, it will be, as I've said before, the beginning of World War III. Syria may be the other avenue into it, because who's Syria's top ally? Iran. And as we have seen from reports that came out in WikiLeaks, the United States and the West has been very instrumental in undermining the Syrian government, even before the latest uprisings have begun.
You also say that there will be a global game changer this year because of the election.
Look at the people running for office. Look how disgusted the people are with them. It's going to be in the United States, it's going to be another lesser of two evils.
You predicted that Barack Obama would win, right?
No, we said Barack Obama would win back in October. We put our forecast out. If the current front runner is Romney, for example, or or Gingrich or Santorum, the only wild card in this, as we see it, is Ron Paul.
If U.S. President Barack Obama wins a second term, do you think that he'll change course in any way, because he'll have a bit more freedom in his second term than in his first term?
Didn't Obama, when he got elected in 2009, have the entire nation virtually behind him? Do you remember the cheerleading in Grant Park? Do you remember that he had a Democratic Congress behind him? Do you remember that the people gave him everything that he wanted? And do you also remember all the backtracks that Obama went through? Remember Obama, first day he hits the stage, "I'm going to close Guantanamo in a year, Jack. Hey, and remember those Bush tax cuts, no more for me, adios. Hey, remember that rendition, ain't going to happen under my watch. Oh, and those ugly wars that Bush had, how about some more Predator drones into Pakistan? How about up in the troop level in Afghanistan? I'll tell you what, after another 4 years of Obama, people are going to be wanting Bush back."
And what will be the game-changing trend or trends for 2012?
As I see it, there are four things that could change the future. One is repatriate, repatriate. Bring your jobs back home. Bring production back home. Is it going to cost a little more? Yes. But guess what? You're going to get paid more. And that quality is going to be better. For the trend to change, it has to begin at the grassroots. It's not only Americans. It's every country having national pride in what they do best. Number two, direct democracy. Let the people vote. Let the people vote on major issues. I don't need, as I said, a gang of 535 telling me we have to go to war against Libya. We have to go to war against Iraq. We have to go to war against now Iran. Let the people vote. You want the war on drugs to keep going? Let the people vote. You want to bail out banks? Let the people vote. Right now, as I said, we have politicians telling us how to think, how to eat, what to believe, what not to believe, what to watch, and what not to watch. Number three, secession. It's too big. The Soviet Union knows this story, and the United States should get the same story in their heads. It can't be run by a central government anymore. You think the Taliban want to invade Vermont? You think they got their eye on Utah? You know, here we are, it's 10 years after 9/11. And they're still putting out that same phony line, that the reason that they want to invade us is because they hate our freedom and liberty. Freedom and liberty? Hey, anybody read the National Defense Authorization Act? Hey, you've been felt up at the airport lately? Flying the friendly skies? GPS signal under your car? Cops watching you? Listen, what freedom? What liberty? Now, it has to do with foreign policy. My favorite trend of all of them, going out in style. Put style back into the system.
Amid the still ongoing economic hardship and joblessness and unemployment, are there any smart investments? Are there any successful moves to make?
Break the chains. Break the chains in every single way you can. You stop going to the chain stores and you start buying local. You start filling the market niche's needs. Where is it going to be the biggest growth? Was obvious. The whole IT movement is just going to continue to grow.
Cybersecurity, right?
Cybersecurity is going to be huge because they're going to keep hacking into it, and it's going to be a fight between the government and freedom. So anything having to do with cybersecurity is huge business. The other ones are anything having to do with healthcare. Anything. We're an aging society in the European nations and in America. Anything having to do with healthcare, alternative healthcare particularly. There's plenty of options and plenty of opportunities, but nothing is going to change until the individual changes. And that's the most important aspect to understand.
Gerald Salenti, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, Moses, we're going to the phone lines. Area code 804. Tell me who you are, where you're calling from, and what's your question or comments in regards to what we're discussing here this evening. Area code 804. Hey, man.
Hello. How you doing, brother? Peace.
Hey, peace, brother. I'm fine.
I was just listening. I appreciate what you're doing. Calling from Richmond, VA.
Okay, what's your name, bro?
J. Elohim.
Okay, all right. Well, you have any questions?
No, sir, but if I do, I'll click one again.
All right. Okay, well, hang on in. We finna go into something else, and then we'll come back.
All right.
All right. Now, let's go a little deeper, and then we're going to come back up. We're going to examine some other things that I thought was relevant.
And once we separate, not so much as separate spirituality from religions, and understand that out of our spirituality came the world's religions,
the God concept of those religions, of Judaism, Christianity, or Islam, came out of what I refer to as pre-God religions. I don't use that anymore because people don't understand what I mean about pre-God religions. They are so accustomed to the word God, they cannot understand that there was a time when man thought of a force in the universe presiding over the universe. And while he meant God, he did not use the word God. And man had more spirituality before he consistently used the word God. He used the God force and the God concept without using the word. He meant the same thing. And ultimately, Western man interpreted that as meaning the same thing.
Spirituality is a way of accepting the fact that there is a spiritual force in the universe larger than all of mankind.
Let's go back during the time of antiquity. The word antiquity means ancient times.
Yes.
There was no religion, no place on planet Earth. You have to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Going back into Africa, you will find the Africans living in the continent of Africa, not having a religion, but they had a spiritual way of life that included the ancient Egyptians also. They paid homage to their ancestors. They paid homage to nature. They knew the laws, the cosmic laws of the universe, and they lived their lives according to these various laws of the universe.
Man must be in harmony with nature. Must not be in a violent struggle against the elements, and that man and God and nature are in partnership one to the other, and all of the elements work with man, and all life is linked together in cause and effect. In a harmonious chain, there was no death, but a continuation of life from the European concept of life is a violation of harmony. When you look at Russia and the United States, look at their struggle to control the world, it makes no sense. It is out of harmony. Not only with nature, it is out of harmony with common sense. It is a violation of nature to poison the air, to endanger babies. Nature gave you fresh air to breathe. You throw everything out of harmony when you put poison in the air. God created the spring, God created wind to purify the air. He didn't do this for man to put chemicals and spoil the air so that the child couldn't breathe. The African thought about all of this as part of the totality of life. So his religion stemmed out of bringing life in line with the harmony of God's creation. And if we are to create a new way and a new harmony and a new decency for all people, we must bring things in harmony with nature. Because this is the basis of what this ancient African did. This is why he could have 3,000 years without a war.
Now, when we see something like this again, well, our ancestors were into something deep. But again, look very closely. Now that we have broken that down, you see that this person has become what is called a netter, or a spiritual one, or has become God-like, because he rose up his pineal gland, as you see the serpent here. Now his third eye is open. His spiritual eye is open. Okay? So again, we looked at nature. We used symbols. Why did we use symbols? Because symbols operated on the collective consciousness of the mind. Okay? We still have, as Brother Dr. Richard King pointed out, which he expounds on this very well from his research, that even though they have destroyed our libraries, they have not destroyed our genetic libraries that's in us. It's just lying there dormant. All we have to do is open it up.
It is here that our ancestors had a study from the 42 books of Tahuti, representing science, law, and intelligence, who was represented as the ibis bird that you saw. We saw those little white birds that we saw come over here. So our ancestors looked at nature. We didn't worship the bird, but it was an attribute of science, attribute of intelligence. Tahuti writing down the deeds of our life on earth as we lived here. This is where the Western philosophical thought Greeks took their concept of Hermetrismegistus from Tahuti, now called thought too.
Again, our ancestors looked at nature to symbolize various attributes of nature. We did not worship insects. We did not worship animals. Okay? They represented various attributes of nature. For instance, the little scarab beetle was symbolized as the great mind. Why? Because the top of the little scarab beetle was identical to the top of the cranial cavity of the brain. So the little scarab was looked at as the great mind of Ptah. That was Ptah's symbol, the scarab, that created the universe. Also how the scarab, okay, would roll up his dung, okay, and make the sun. That was a symbol of being self-created, because the eggs would have to feed from the dung, and that was a symbolic as being self-created. Now, when we see something like this, we say, I sure don't understand what our ancestors was doing back in those days. They put this big bug on this body. What in the world is this? What you see here, remember I said in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and the Spirit of God moved across the deep? Okay? So we see nothing but darkness. The scarab symbolized Ptah, black. The red body symbolized the sun that was created. Our ancestors saw ourselves in relationship with that of nature. We were totally connected with nature. We did not worship animals and insects. They were various attributes because we looked at nature for our communication. Okay? That's why we were not destructive towards nature. So what we see is mind over body. And that's how we see the little scarab creating the sun, because it's red, like you see the body here is being red. Okay? The body was looked at as the great sun. That's why you call your son the sun today. symbolized is that sun. Okay? So here we see the little scarab rolling up the dung, was symbolic as how Patel rolled up the sun in the universe and created the light. This was all symbolic and all various attributes.
We need to look back and study our origins and where we came from. Try now to imagine Earth in prehistoric times, a place filled with a multitude of dangers, giant animals and reptiles, huge predators, earthquakes, volcanoes, tornadoes, and meteors, and the subsequent fear and hostility such an unfriendly environment would breed. If you could be a time traveler and be spirited back to these ancient times, complete with all the sophisticated modern knowledge you now have, admit it, you'd be scared to death, I know I would be. Now try to imagine what it must have been like for these ancient people, totally devoid of all the knowledge we now take for granted about the awesome forces of nature. A volcano erupts, destroying everything in its path. The sky reverberates with thunder as a violent electrical storm hurls thunderbolts to Earth, which start fires. Tornadoes sweep people, animals, and trees away into the sky. The Earth opens up and an earthquake swallows a village in the twinkling of an eye. Gazing up into those fearsome skies filled with infinite numbers of stars, not to mention shooting stars, without having the remotest idea of what they were, lacking any form of scientific explanation. Is it any wonder that these ancient peoples created a myriad of all-powerful nature gods and the countless myths that surrounded them? The gods which have been worshipped and sacrificed to for thousands of years since then, the sun, which became known as God's sun, the light of the world. Human beings are the only creatures capable of the process of logical thought, of imagination, and of questioning everything around them.
Now you can see all three pyramids. Now in the further back is the pyramid of Khufu, Khafra, and Menkaure. Keep in mind, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors had astronomical science, astrology, where they studied the stars and so forth. One of the things that's been brought to astronomers' attention is that they noticed that the pyramid of Khufu and Khafra, if you notice right here, are in a perfect alignment. Okay? It's a perfect alignment. But the question is that why with such a perfect alignment and perfect structure where they built the small pyramid of Menkaure off course? Can you see it off course?
Yeah.
But what they found, though, is that our ancestors were building the pyramids in alignment with the stars, that they were in rhythm with the astrology and the astronomical science of the universe, science of astrology or the study of the stars. And what they found is that the star system Orion was the star system of Osiris. Remember, the king wants to become one with Osiris. So by aligning the pyramid of Khufu, Khafra, and Menkaure with Orion, and that's why they built the pyramid of Menkaure slightly over and not in alignment, because the pyramids were built off of the alignment of the star system Orion. The star system Ceres was Isis. So our ancestors, in essence, were building heaven on earth. They were taking the science of the stars and building the pyramids exactly as they saw the heavenly body or the cosmological universe. Figure out why Menkaure's pyramid was not in a perfect alignment, but it fits with the alignment of the star system Orion. As well as the other pyramid layout, it fits into the constellation that our ancestors saw of Osiris. And that is the constellation of the man that they have today as a figure of a man. So you can take and put the star system Orion right over the pyramid of Khufu, Khafra, and Menkaure and see why they had the alignment of Menkaure slightly over, because it fit with the star system Orion, because the purpose was for the soul to ascend into heaven, for the spirit to ascend into heaven, to become one with Osiris. And the star system Orion was connected with Osiris. Keep in mind that the star system Orion was aligned perfectly with the chambers of the pyramids that we're going to deal with later on in our lecture series when we get into it. So this is serious knowledge to show you how profound our ancestors saw that they were building and with the constellation of the universe. Tomorrow when you go into Saqqara, you're also going to see the Pyramid of Unas, showing the first concept of ascension into heaven. Long before there was Christianity, long before there were little white angels with wings under, that we get a concept that we're going to go to heaven, Unas already had the concept of ascension into heaven, or a spirit going into heaven, known as astral theology. So this is what our ancestors saw. the soul becoming one with the great god Osiris in the constellation of Orion, which was the symbol for Osiris. And the star system Ceres was for Isis. Powerful astronomical knowledge that our ancestors had, showing how in tune our ancestors were with the heavenly bodies. In essence, building heaven on earth.
Spirituality is a way of accepting the fact that there is a spiritual force in the universe larger than all of mankind. But someone had to come along and invent a word called God. And someone had to say of another God and say, mine is better than yours. And someone had to create faith. Someone said, I have the true faith. Religion is the organization of spirituality into something that became the handmaiden of conquerors. Nearly all religions were brought to people and imposed on people by conquerors and used as the framework to control their minds. My main point here is that if you are a child of God and God is a part of you, then in your imagination, God's supposed to look like you. And when you accept a picture of the deity assigned to you by another people, you become the spiritual prisoners of that other people.
The representation of God should always be great. It should always be black, because it can produce all things. The representation of God should always be great. It should always be black, because it can produce all things. The representation of God should always be great. It should always be black, because it can produce all things. The representation of God should always be great. It should always be black, because it can produce all things.
Okay, Moses, we're back. Now, I wanted to play that to put down a brief foundation so that, and the reason being is because you can take money that we have today, and if you go through the books and go backwards in time, you will find that the money, there was a time when money was not used as a medium of exchange, and you will trace that money all the way back to religion and beyond, but it has to go back to its original source. And you will, when you do the research, now there is a lot of information that's being concealed and a lot of stuff that's covered up, but there is enough information available to you to go back and look at the origins of money. You can't just get an article and just read that article and that's it. You're gonna have to go back a little bit further, and I want to introduce someone else to you today involving the main investment that I was talking about earlier and our survival and dealing with the basic structure that contributes to the survival of life, because that's what it's going to boil down to. And I was checking the brother out, and some of you may have listened to him before. His name is Ron Finley, and some of the little language he used is a little rough, but that's okay. What he got to say is very, very important, and I'm going to let him rip.
I live in South Central. This is South Central. Liquor stores, fast food, vacant lots. So the city planners, they get together and they figure they're going to change the name South Central to make it represent something else. So they change it to South Los Angeles. Like, this is going to fix what's really going wrong in the city. This is South Los Angeles. Liquor stores, fast food, vacant lots. Just like 26.5 million other Americans, I live in a food desert. South Central Los Angeles, home of the drive-through and the drive-by. Funny thing is, the drive-throughs are killing more people than the drive-by. People are dying from curable diseases in South Central Los Angeles. For instance, the obesity rate in my neighborhood is like 5 times higher than, say, Beverly Hills, which is like probably 8-10 miles away. I got tired of seeing this happening. And I wonder, how would you feel if you had no access to healthy food? If every time you walk out your door, you see the ill effects that the present food system have on your neighborhood? I see wheelchairs bought and sold like used cars. I see dialysis centers popping up like Starbucks. And I figured, this has to stop. So I figured that the problem is the solution. Food is the problem, and food is the solution. Plus, I got tired of driving 45 minutes round trip to get an apple that wasn't impregnated with pesticides. So what I did, I planted a food forest in front of my house. It's on a strip of land that we call a parkway. It's like 150 feet by like 10 feet. The thing is, it's owned by the city, but you have to maintain it. So I'm like, cool. I do whatever the hell I want. Since it's my responsibility and I got to maintain it, and this is how I decided to maintain it. So me and my group, L.A. Green Grounds, we got together and we started planting my food forest, fruit trees, you know, the whole nine, for vegetables. What we do, we're a pay-it-forward kind of group, where it's composed of, like, gardeners from all walks of life from all over the city, and it's completely volunteer, and everything we do is free. And in the garden, it was beautiful. And then somebody complained. The city came down on me. and basically gave me a citation saying that I had to remove my garden, which this citation was turned into a warrant. And I'm like, come on, really? A warrant for planting food on a piece of land that you could care less about? And I was like, cool, bring it. Because this time it wasn't coming up. So L.A. Times got hold of it. Steve Lopez did a story on it and talked to the councilman. And one of the Green Grounds members, they put up a petition on change.org. And with 900 signatures, we were a success. We had a victory on our hands. My councilman even called and said how they endorse and love what we're doing. I mean, come on, why wouldn't they? L.A. leads the United States in vacant lots that the city actually owns. They own 26 square miles of vacant lots. That's 20 Central Parks. That's enough space to plant 700 million, 725 million tomato plants. Why in the hell would they not okay this? Growing one plant will give you 1,000, 10,000 seeds. Okay. When $1 worth of green beans will give you like $75 worth of produce. It's my gospel. I'm telling people, grow your own food. Growing your own food is like printing your own money. Thank you. See, I have a legacy in South Central. I grew up there. I raised my sons there. And I refuse to be a part of this manufactured reality that was manufactured for me by some other people, and I'm manufacturing my own reality. See, I'm an artist. Gardening is my graffiti. I grow my art. Just like a graffiti artist, where they beautify walls, me, I beautify lawns, parkways. I use the garden, the soil, like it's a piece of cloth. And the plants and the trees, that's my embellishment for that cloth. You'd be surprised what the soil could do if you let it be your canvas. You just couldn't imagine how amazing a sunflower is and how it affects people. So what happened? I have witnessed my garden become a tool for the education, a tool for the transformation of my neighborhood. To change the community, you have to change the composition of the soil. We are the soil. You'd be surprised how kids are affected by this. Gardening is the most therapeutic and defiant act you can do, especially in the inner city. Plus, you get strawberries. I remember this time, there was this mother and a daughter came. They were. It was like 10:30 at night, and they were in my yard. And I came out, and they looked so ashamed. You know, I'm like, man, it made me feel bad that they were there. And I told them, you don't have to do this like this. This is on the street for a reason. It made me feel ashamed to see people that was this close to me that was hungry. And this only reinforced why I do this. And people asked me, Finn, aren't you afraid people are going to steal your food? And I'm like, hell no, I ain't afraid they're going to steal it. That's why it's on the street. That's the whole idea. I want them to take it, but in the same time, I want them to take back their health. There's another time when I put a garden in this homeless shelter in downtown Los Angeles. The guys, they helped me unload the truck. It was cool. They just shared the stories about how this affected them and how they used to plant with their mother and their grandmother. And it was just cool to see how this changed them if it was only for that one moment. So Green Grounds has gone on to plant maybe like 20 gardens. We've had like 50 people come to our dig-ins and participate, and it's all volunteers. If kids grow kale, kids eat kale. If they grow tomatoes, they eat tomatoes. But when none of this is presented to them, if they're not shown how food affects the mind and the body, they blindly eat whatever the hell you put in front of them. I see young people, and they want to work. But they're in this thing where they're caught up. I see kids of color, and they just on this track that's designed for them that leads them to nowhere. So with gardening, I see an opportunity where we can train these kids to take over their communities, to have a sustainable life. And when we do this, who knows? We might produce the next George Washington Carver. But if we don't change the composition of the soil, we will never do this. Now, this is one of my plans. This is what I want to do. I want to plant a whole block of gardens where people can share in the food in the same block. I want to take shipping containers and turn them into healthy cafes. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about no free shit. Because free is not sustainable. The funny thing about sustainability, you have to sustain it. What I'm talking about is putting people to work and getting kids off the street and letting them know the joy, the pride, and the honor in growing your own food, opening farmers markets. So what I want to do here, we got to make this sexy. So I want us all to become ecolutionary, renegades, gangsters, gangster gardeners. We got to change flip the script on what a gangster is. If you ain't a gardener, you ain't gangster. Get gangster with your shovel, okay? And let that be your weapon of choice. So basically, if you want to meet with me, if you want to meet, don't call me. If you want to sit around in cushy chairs and have meetings where you talk about doing some shit, if you want to meet with me, come to the garden with your shovel so we can plant some shit. Peace. Thank you.
No need to add soil, pesticides, or even water to this 6x8-foot garden, which produces over 100 pounds of fish and 400 vegetables a year. What kind of food facility is this? For one of our next 500 companies, it's a system about to revolutionize how the world eats.
You are literally at the front edge of probably the most important technology that's come down the pike in food in a century, and it will impact more people over the next 25 years than anything else we know of.
Portable Farms makes on-site food production facilities using aquaponics, a unique farming technique using fish and plants.
When you mix aquaculture, which is raising fish in captivity, feeding them, and raising plants in water. And what we've done is we've combined the hydroponic component with the aquaculture component. So we raise the fish, use the fish waste to fertilize the plants.
Coley first pioneered the concept for portable farms in 1972 while he was a student.
It started by having to clean fish tanks at UC Davis. So it's like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And I started with a dish pan sitting on top of a fish tank with sand in it. The water's coming in. Plants grew like crazy for 2 weeks, and then they didn't like the water on their fruits all the time, and they quit. So I had to figure out, how do I make this work? 37 years ago, from that to this.
Over the decades, Coley engineered a patented system that automatically removes sediments from the fish tank without clogging a pump, allowing fish and vegetables to grow healthier and faster than in any other aquaponic systems seen yet.
I wanted to make this so bulletproof that I could have my neighbor have this and not have Dave and Lisa call me up at 3 in the morning and say there's something wrong. So everything that we've done is to make it more and more and more reliable and simple. Mm-hmm. Make it as simple as you possibly can and still work.
Although a lot of engineering goes into a portable farm, like its gravel size, flow rate of water, and fish ratios, running a portable farm takes no special training.
People say, well, I'm not a farmer, I'm not a gardener. I go, well, can you harvest tomatoes? And they go,
well, yeah.
I said, can you pull a plant out?
Well, yeah.
So I literally show them that you can take the old plant out and put a new plant in.
For such a farm that requires little work and no training, the results are impressive.
The largest unit, the 100 by 100 foot unit, 10,000 square feet, produces enough lettuce to produce 400 side salads a day. 400
wow.
side salads a day. Okay? And if you added in a few other ingredients, you could produce literally 500 to 600 salads a day, and you can serve 500 4-ounce fillets every 2 weeks. These things are incredibly productive.
Portable farms are so productive because fish stay in tanks wrapped with warming material, and plants stay under a greenhouse, cycling the same water over and over. As long as the farm can get a source of light and keep from freezing, portable farms can go anywhere.
Whether it's Southern California, Washington, upstate New York, Maine, Canada, these can be put in the Antarctic, for crying out loud. As long as you have grow lights, they can go anywhere. Our goal is eventually to have them all over the world.
Just a year ago, Coley and his wife decided to make portable farms their sole commitment. They wrote one press release announcing the new farm systems were available for purchase.
In 10 days, we had people from 121 countries look at our website. From all over. I'm just like, wow, what's going on?
One newspaper article published soon after compelled people to visit the Portable Farms headquarters.
People just showed up. We took our website, we took our address off our website so people wouldn't show up. We've had 4,000 individuals come through here since January.
Portable Farms had to stop giving tours in order to focus on its business and is now working with 38 countries as well as with military bases, schools, prisons, and entire communities in need of food.
This is disruptive technology because you can now grow protein and vegetables in every city. These can be put on rooftops. These can be put in empty lots. So because you're raising food on site, you're creating it so that if you have pockets of hunger, you can put one of these units in and alleviate that hunger on the spot.
Portable farms may be able to impact the hunger dilemmas facing much of the world, including the U.S.
The statistic from Feeding America is that 1 in 8 Americans goes to bed at night hungry. That's the United States. That's an astonishing figure. And then in the world, basically 1 out of every 6 people is starving from protein malnutrition. How can you help that? Well, little by little, we may be able to put a dent in that.
A dent may be an understatement. This next 500 company may lead a global game change for food production.
Will this change the world? In 25 years, this will be part of the landscape. Everywhere you go, you will see portable. People won't notice them anymore. They'll be that pervasive.
All right, there you go. That's the investment right there. This is the way I look at it. Just with just pure common sense. Okay. We got all of these economic upheavals. Every day, starting in the morning, all day and all night. You get in your car, you're on the way to work, it's 5 o'clock in the morning, you got to go way on the other side of town, so you cut on the radio. You're listening to the news. This happened, that happened. This we're looking at this going to happen. This is going to happen later on. And please don't forget about this going to happen and all of this. So we are constantly being fed a steady diet of what's wrong in the country, day in and day out, all day, every day. I don't look at no TV. I can't listen to junk no more. I had to get off that merry-go-round. My question is, what is the solution to the problem? If we got a problem with the money, what's the solution? What is the best solution that we can, if we got 1 in 6 people in the world starving, and we got the same type of statistics going on inside the United States, it is obvious to me what a major investment or place that I should be putting my money in. If I look at, okay, I'm going to invest in CDs, I'm going to invest in bonds, okay, I'm going to invest in silver, I'm going to invest in gold, I'm going to invest in real estate. Okay, we're going to say you invest in real estate and you got 10 houses. And these houses are they're all filled with occupants, and all the occupants are steady giving you this money. And what we have a tendency to do when we start getting this kind of capital, then the next thing that we want to do, we want to up our lifestyle. We don't want to reduce our standard of living in the face of the global or national coming catastrophe, because we are too smart. We have arrived. So what we're going to do is we're going to take our money from all of these rental properties, all these houses we sold, and we're going to buy a bigger and better house to live in. We're going to buy not one Cadillac, but 2 Cadillacs. We're going to get a better wife. We're going to go out and get a new wardrobe. We're going to buy new patio furniture. We're going to get a big swimming pool. And with our smart self, we are amazing. I know the Creator got a sense of humor because He gave us one, but I know He sure must be using his up there. with the stuff we've been doing down here. I don't eat okra. I don't eat tomatoes. I don't eat onions. I don't do this, I don't do that. Well, what is amazing is you discover is when you ain't got nothing but that, you kill somebody who try to get you on you. But all jokes aside, we're going to continue with this, and we're coming back to where we just left, but we're going to look at some other things. We want to deal with this police situation again, stopping you on the streets now. We're going to, and deal with that and how some facts that we need to understand involving that.
Okay, here's some facts you need to know when you're being pulled over for a DUI. Okay, now, every time you're pulled over, you're technically being pulled over for a DUI because officers use what are called pretextual reasons to stop you. Ever since the court said that the police can pull you over for any reason at all, no matter what the pretext, your tag light's out, you weaved, anything like that, that gives them the authority to make a reasonable inquiry as to your driving. So what the cops do, when they walk up to the car, they're not really going to just write you a ticket and say, here you go, don't speed or don't weave or fix your tag light. They're using that as an opportunity to try to see if you've been drinking. So the problem is most people, usually when they go out to dinner or when they go to an event, will have a beer, maybe two beers or a mixed drink. Now, if you've waited a certain amount of time and the blood alcohol in your system is low enough that you're not impaired, you get in the car and you go home because nobody wants to drive drunk. But here's what happens. You get pulled over, and the officer, having pulled you over for a pretext, walks up to you, and usually the second or third question out of the officer's mouth is, have you been drinking? Now, if you answer yes, you are automatically going to go to jail for DUI because it doesn't matter what happens after that. The officer is going to charge you with DUI because you've given him the answer that he wants to hear to go forward with his investigation. Now, the first thing the officer is going to do is he's going to ask you to step out of the car. He's going to ask you to perform what are called field sobriety tests. Now, field sobriety tests are nothing more than divided attention tests. It's akin to rubbing your belly and scratching your head, or rubbing your belly, patting yourself on the head, or trying to play the guitar while you are doing high-level math exercise. It doesn't work, okay? There is a manual that's published by the federal government, and it's a manual of field sobriety tests. And this manual is the basis for all field sobriety tests. And what this manual does is it recommends three approved field sobriety tests. And they are the horizontal gaze nystagmus, which is where the officer places something in front of your eyes and does like this, and you're supposed to follow it with your eyes. The second one is the walk and turn, where you walk heel to toe down a line, and then you're to turn without losing your balance and walk back. And the last one is you stand on one leg and you count to 30. Now, something you need to understand is all of those tests are designed for you to fail them. They are not designed for you to pass them. And the person who decides whether or not you fail is the officer. But here's an interesting statistic. According to the National Highway Transportation Agency, 9% of people can't pass a field sobriety test at all, 9%. 12% cannot pass the horizontal gaze nystagmus test. 21% cannot pass the walk and turn test. And 17% cannot pass the one leg stand test when sober. When sober. So if you're asked to do a one leg stand test and you're cold sober, there's a 17% chance you're going to fail it even though you're sober. If you're asked to do the walk and turn, there's a 21% chance that you're going to fail it, even stone cold sober. And if you're asked to do the horizontal gaze and nystagmus, there's a 12% chance that you're going to fail that stone cold sober. Now, the horizontal gaze and nystagmus test is a very controversial test, and many states, including Alabama, do not allow its admission and evidence as proof of guilt. Now, officers try to sneak it in to claim probable cause, but it's bogus science. What it's based upon is the belief that as you move your eye, as you're moving your eye, if you're intoxicated, your eye flickers. Well, horizontal gaze nystagmus is one of those things that occurs in many circumstances, including situations where you have fatigue at night. If you've been driving in the dark for a long period of time on the interstate and the white lines of the road are going by and the headlights are coming at you, that causes nystagmus too. So if you're pulled over at night, stone cold sober, and an officer sticks a pen in your face and does like this, you're not going to pass that test. First of all, the officer is the one that's going to be judging whether you pass it. And second of all, 90% of the time, if you've been driving for more than 3 hours at night, your eyes are already doing a really bad nystagmus simply because their eyes are fatigued. Light and dark extremes cause fatigue. So if an officer asks you to step out of a car and perform field sobriety tests, you have the right to decline to do so. You don't have to be rude about it. You don't have to be aggressive. You just say, no, I don't want to do that. And he'll say, well, will you perform this nystagmus test? No, I don't want to do that. Will you perform this one-leg turn? No, I don't want to do that. Will you perform the one-leg stand? No, I don't want to do that. The officer is then going to hold up a little machine that fits in the palm of his hand. It is called a PBT, a portable breath test machine. He's going to ask you to blow into it. Now, that PBT is inadmissible in court. It's not admissible at trial. But if you blow into it, you are going to give him another element of probable cause. Now, you don't have to do that either. You can say, no, I don't want to do that. Because no matter what happens, once he asks you to step out of the car, he's going to arrest you. He's going to put you in jail. He is going to fail your field sobriety test, and he's going to have you blown the PBT. And it doesn't matter what the PBT says, he's still going to arrest you. Because he's going to say, if you fail the PBT, he's going to say that you were drinking. And if you don't fail the PBT, he's going to use the field sobriety tests as the reason for you being arrested. So what you've done is by refusing to do the field sobriety and refusing to do the PBT, you have prevented him from gathering evidence that you've been driving under the influence. Now, if the officer pulls you over and approaches your car, and he says to you, have you been drinking? And you answer no. You've further deprived him of a confession that you've been drinking. So if you say no, technically under the law, he has no further probable cause to go further with any investigation as to DUI. Now, he may say, well, I smell alcohol on you. Have you been drinking? You can still say no. If you haven't been drinking, and the sad fact is, a lot of police officers will say, I smell alcohol on you. Have you been drinking? Even when they don't actually smell alcohol. Now, if you've been out drinking and you had a glass of wine at dinner 4 hours earlier, and an officer says to you, I smell alcohol. Have you been drinking? What are you going to do? You're going to go, oh, my God, he can smell alcohol on me? I only had one drink. And then you're going to get all nervous. Don't get nervous. One drink at dinner 4 hours before you drive home is not enough for you to be driving under the influence. Okay? You've had plenty of time to have that alcohol process out of your system and metabolize, and your liver's already taking care of detoxifying it, and you've already urinated, and you're done, okay? But a cop is going to say that very often just to throw you off, just to make you nervous, and then he's going to have you do these field sobriety. So if you haven't been drinking or you've been drinking a long time before, just say no. And when he asks you to do field sobriety, just say no. and he asks you to do the PBT test, just say no. If he's gotten you out of the car to do field sobriety, he's going to arrest you for DUI. If he leaves you sitting in the car, he's not serious about any DUI arrest. But if he asks you to step out, assume you're going to jail, don't give the officer any evidence to convict you. Now, the last part of a DUI arrest involves the issue of the breath test machine. In many states, that's a machine called the Draeger. If you decline to take that test, most states will suspend your driver's license, some for 6 months, some for 180 days, just depends, but some for a year. But if you take that test, you are now giving the police evidence of the blood alcohol in your system. If you decline to take the test, you are depriving the officer of the last piece of evidence that he needs to convict you. Now, you're going to have your license suspended if you do that. But in many states, the mere fact that you're arrested for DUI, your license is going to be suspended anyway. So keep that in mind as you are being asked at a police station to take a Draeger test or whatever breath machine test that they want you to take. If you don't take the test, you have effectively prevented the officer from gathering any evidence as to you being under the influence while driving the vehicle. So if you say no when you're asked if you've been drinking, and you have to be truthful. So if you haven't been drinking, or if you've been drinking hours before, no, I haven't had a drink. Number two, don't do the field sobriety tests. You're not required to do them. Number three, don't blow into the portable breath test, the little handheld. And number four, make an informed decision as to whether or not you want to take that breath test at the police station. If you take it and you have been drinking, then of course you're going to show that you have alcohol in your system. If you don't take it, then the license will be suspended most likely by your state Department of Public Safety or driver's license authority. But you will have deprived the officer of evidence against you. In cases where my clients are non-compliant, they don't answer the officer about alcohol, they don't take field sobriety, they don't do the PBT, and they don't do the breath test machine at the police station, clients of mine that have done that have 100% been found not guilty. So you need to think about those things if you get pulled over by an officer for DUI.
Okay. Now, I would like to add on to that. And the first thing that I have people do, especially if they intend on exercising the right to travel, because the only person who needs a driver's license in the first place is someone who has an occupation to drive. If you're driving a tractor trailer, if you're driving a city bus, if you're driving a taxi cab, if you're driving an ambulance, if you're driving a fire truck, if you're driving any kind of vehicle operating in commerce, you are the only person who needs a driver's license. Nobody else but you. Any kind of vehicle that you're driving, if it's operating in commerce, if it's a vehicle for daycare, if it's a vehicle for picking up handicapped people, city bus, school bus, these are vehicles that operate in commerce. If you're not doing that, the last thing that you want to have is a driver's license in the first place. Now, in order for you to enforce this, on top of what you just heard here involving that, I recommend that you go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, click on the link to HawkerArchives.org, and inside to Hawker Archives Master Library is step-by-step of how to learn how to enforce your position. Now, one other thing that I want to recommend, in what this guy talked about, is he talked about evidence. Remember, no evidence, no case. He got a 100% success rate because there was no evidence, so therefore, the policeman, which is not officers, he kept using the wrong term, officers, they're not officers of the law. These are private contractors. They're not peace officers. This is all stuff that's been attached to them. They are the equivalent of security guards once you know the law and are able to enforce that law. However, At any point in time that you or somebody cut their lights on you or flashing, they're declaring an emergency. It is a good idea to have a dash cam. Have one mounted in the back, a little small one that's hard to detect. Have one mounted in the back doors. Have the audio on, video on. Have one definitely put in the passenger door so it can shine toward the driver and the confrontation with you and the private contractor. You might want to consider having one on a little necklace around the rearview mirror. You might want to have one installed on your wrist. You might want to have one around your neck so you can gather this information, upload it to the computer, and send it downtown and let them know how much you're suing them for. And make sure that you get the officer's name, his car number. Make sure that if he doesn't want to give you a badge number, just ask him what's his car number. That way you have enough information to do a trace on him, find out where his, if he has a wife, she can be served with a summons to appear in court as an accessory after the fact of the crime of declaring an emergency, attempting to extort revenue from you as a highwayman because you're exercising your right to travel and you're not operating in a commercial context. So I would recommend that you get that. And when you get over there, give me a call, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. so that we can do the whole thing. And we also want to add the sheriff in there because this guy is working under his administration, so therefore he's responsible. Well, that's the first line of defense. If any lawyers could jump out the woodwork or jump out the bushes, we have something to definitely put them back in the bushes or throw them under the bus. Wherever you have to put them at. But all this information is available to you so that you can do what you got to do. Now, you may not get a chance to do this but one good time, and after that you'll be some kin to the gentleman they used to have on TV back in the 60s. His name was Robert Stack. He used to be called the Untouchables. Now, we're going to go on to this thing about these sovereign citizens. Let's deal with some of that. Let's find out, what is a sovereign citizen? What is that? What is a sovereign citizen? Okay? Because we got a lot of that kind of stuff going on inside the United States. So let's deal with that for a minute. Let's find out what it is. Who are sovereign citizens? Who are these people?
Best of the rest of the news, there are between 100,000 and a half million Americans who believe the United States government and its court system are completely illegitimate. As a result, these Americans typically don't obey many laws, sometimes drive without driver's licenses, and don't pay taxes. And no, I'm not talking about General Electric. Instead, I'm talking about the sovereign citizen movement. It's a loosely organized group of Americans from around the nation who, for the most part, operate under the radar. And with numerous lawsuits against police and public officials, and behavior sometimes outside our legal system, sovereign citizens are becoming a real thorn in the side of local, state, and federal governments. But now the state of Georgia wants to fight back. Republican State Representative B.J. Pack introduced legislation to disarm sovereign citizens, one of their most frequently used tactics, the filing of lawsuits and liens to tie up public officials in costly legal battles. The legislation would criminalize filing false liens with a fine of up to $10,000 and jail terms of up from 1 to 10 years. So how will this bill affect the sovereign citizen movement, and what exactly are they after? Joining me now is Alfred Adask, sovereign citizen and constitutionalist, as well as a talk radio host and the author of several books, including The Nature of Money. Alfred, welcome.
Hi. How are you doing, Tom?
Great to have you with us. Now, if I understand this right, what you call American common law has been hijacked by admiralty law, which is why our birth certificates and driver's licenses are printed in all capital letters. And when we're born, our government creates a secret shell corporation using our name in all caps and keeps hundreds of thousands of dollars in that account. Is that a reasonable description of your position?
It's not a reasonable description of my position, but it's a reasonable description of a number of people's position. I'm aware of a bunch of different theories, and you know, when you talk about, people talk about a sovereignty movement as if it was monolithic, and it's not. There's a large variety of people who have different slants on the sovereignty concept.
So,
and the one you're describing is embraced by some people, but it's not embraced by all.
Okay. So you said this isn't one that you particularly embrace. What then for you makes you a sovereign citizen as opposed to the persons that I just described?
Declaration of Independence. If you understand sovereignty, you're going to go back in history to begin to grasp the concept. When you had a king in England, or a king in France, or a king in Spain, they were sovereign. The reason they were sovereign is because they went through a coronation ceremony in a church. The church declared them to be king, and they gave them a crown to wear on their head, and that crown was intended to emulate the corona you see around the heads of the Christ and the saints in medieval paintings. The idea was that the kings, the sovereigns, received their rights directly from God. They had the divine right of kings.
And Jefferson flipped that upside down.
He didn't just flip it upside down. He destroyed it. Everyone in England, the only person in England who was a sovereign was the king. He got his rights directly from God. All else were subjects because they did not get their rights from God.
No, I get that, and I totally get it. That, you know, what Jefferson was saying is that we the people are the sovereigns in this nation, but the Declaration of Independence was written by a group of people who were occupied by a foreign nation, and they threw off those occupiers. They threw, you know, much like, you know, the people in Iraq or Afghanistan are trying to get rid of us, I think. We are not, to the best of my knowledge, right now, occupied by a foreign nation. We are occupied by us. Our government is
sovereignty
us.
Has nothing to do with whether you're occupied or not. Sovereignty flows from God. What people, most people don't understand, including people in the alleged sovereignty movement, they don't understand that this is a spiritual concept. This is not simply politics. This is spiritual. It's based on the idea.
But what would you make different, Alfred? What would you make different than from today's, you know, today's government? If right now, you know, the U.S. government
is a matter of recognition. There's a case called Chisholm versus Georgia, 1793, the Supreme Court. This is 4 years after the Constitution was adapted, 17 years after the Declaration of Independence, and I'm looking at it and I'm reading from it right now, and it says in part, they're talking about the situation in England and Europe, how it compared to a particular case, and the court says the same feudal ideas run through all their jurisprudence, meaning the English jurisprudence, and constantly remind us of the distinction.
So you think America is becoming feudalistic?
And the subject, well, it's becoming fascist.
Okay. Is it a problem for you that, you know, okay, let me finish.
This is important. You can find this for yourself. You look up the case Chisholm versus Georgia, 1793. It continues. At first, they talk about feudalism, where the prince is different from the subject, the prince being the sovereign. It says, no such ideas obtain here. At the revolution, the sovereignty devolved on the people, and they are truly the sovereigns.
How is that different from today?
It's absolute. Here's the difference.
Give me an example.
If I'm a sovereign, the government is my public servant.
Right.
If I'm not a sovereign, I'm a subject, and the government is my master.
So,
and that is the fundamental conflict that's going on right now.
So you think that you shouldn't be able, you shouldn't have to answer to a police officer who says you're speeding?
Not in that at all. There's some people that they take that idea and they run with it. The sovereign, there's some people who claim that they are sovereigns and they don't have to obey any laws.
Right.
Those people aren't sovereigns, they are anarchists. There's a completely different situation.
What about the sovereign citizens who complain that America is getting less white and more brown, less Christian and more Muslim and atheist, and therefore it's not consistent with the founding? Your thoughts on that?
I don't think that it's relevant to sovereignty. Declaration says all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. That establishes we are all getting our rights from God. It establishes that we are all sovereigns in the same sense that the King of England was a sovereign because he had the divine right of kings.
Is our sovereignty infringed upon by having to pay taxes?
No, not necessarily. Not necessarily.
So what is infringing on our sovereignty, on our individual sovereignty?
Well, what is infringing on our individual sovereignty?
Yeah.
Whenever the government violates the terms of the Constitution.
For example,
there's reason to believe that the income tax was designed to apply only within the territories of the United States.
The income tax then is a violation of our sovereignty.
No, the income tax is legal within the territories, but it may not be legal within the states of the Union.
So it's legal in Puerto Rico, but not here.
It's possible that it appears there's reason to believe that might be true. All right? And it's part of the reason why when people go to court and they complain about the constitutionality of a law, the court will routinely decide in favor of the law's constitutionality. They say if it could be constitutional anywhere, it's okay. It's not unconstitutional.
Alfred, thanks so much for being with us. I'm sorry, we're flat out of time, but you did, I think, a brilliant job of presenting your perspective. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now to hear from the other side in the Sovereign Citizens Movement, here's Mark Potok, Senior Fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mark, welcome.
Well, great to be here once again.
We just heard from a sovereign citizen. Didn't quite sound like a hate group guy. You're characterizing the sovereign citizen movement as essentially a hate group. In fact, I think you've used that term. Why?
Well, no, we don't call them hate groups, and we've not listed them as hate groups. It's funny, I've actually sat in Al Adesk's living room in the Dallas area back in the days when I was reporting on the militia movement in the 1990s. And to be perfectly frank, he's a bit of a nut. And I think that he was being a bit disingenuous in describing his own beliefs. You know, when he says that, for instance, the income tax may only apply in the territories, that goes back to the origins of the sovereign citizen movement, which, in fact, began with white supremacist groups. Now, I'm not accusing Alfred Adesk of being a white supremacist. I don't think that's true. But the reality is that these ideas originated in a group called the Posse Comitatus in the 1970s and the 1980s. Al Adesk had to say. They essentially believe that God gave America to the white man. And therefore, because it's this relationship between God and men, no man can kind of stand between that. And thus their idea, for instance, that the government can't tax you, that the government can't tell you that you've got to have a driver's license, and all kinds of other things the government supposedly cannot do. Mm-hmm. When the posse and a lot of sovereigns refer to 14th Amendment citizens, which is a kind of core concept for sovereigns, what they are really talking about is the idea that black people in America, among others, but black people were made citizens by the 14th Amendment, which is to say they were made citizens by an act of man. As opposed to an act of God. So what that means is that black Americans, having accepted citizenship from men, from an act of the government, they have essentially signed a contract and now have to do everything the government tells them.
And they're not the same kind of citizens as those white people. Is this what animates the whole Obama birth certificate movement?
Well, no, because the reality, oddly enough, is that these very racist origins of the white, of the sovereign citizens movement have been largely forgotten. There are enormous numbers of black Americans right now dabbling in sovereign theories. There's a whole theory that you mentioned about the government keeping secret accounts, and if you file the right documents and so on, you can get millions of dollars. But, you know, what things like the punctuation, for instance, a lot of sovereign groups refuse to capitalize the U in United States. They have odd ways of spelling their names and punctuating their names when they put them down on government and any kind of official documents. And the reason is they believe if in some official document they capitalize the U in United States, they are agreeing, in effect, that the government is real and entering into a contract with the government. Therefore, they, too, become this, just like
Mark, to me, it sounds like what you're describing is paranoid schizophrenia or paranoia anyway.
Well, it's a rather, on the one hand, it's an amusingly kind of wacky set of beliefs, and it does vary from place to place, as Addison
but,
says.
On the other,
these people murder police officers from time to time. We've seen a lot of conflicts between sovereigns who are pulled over by police officers who say, you know, you have no right to pull me over, who will show the officer typically a made-up kind of license or car registration. On May 20th of 2010, there's an infamous case in which a father's son's team of sovereigns murdered two West Memphis, Arkansas police officers in cold blood who had pulled them over
amazing.
As a routine traffic stop.
Mark, thank you. We're out of time. I'd love to spend a lot more time on this. We will revisit this topic in the future. Thanks for dropping by tonight.
In fact, we're talking about the sovereign citizen movement in the U.S. According to a new report by the Southern Poverty Law Center, this is a movement that really is gaining a lot of traction. We've discussed it before, but now they say that there are over 300,000 Americans that consider themselves to be sovereign citizens. But the thing is, the Southern Poverty Law Center also, in their in-depth report, goes into a number of the leaders of this movement and even go to a father and son team who murdered two police officers. So they're calling these people perhaps a danger to society. But is that true? Well, earlier I caught up with someone who is himself a sovereign citizen, and his name is Curtis Nixon. Check it out.
Basically, being what a sovereign citizen is all about is we don't believe that the government should have any control over our actions. You know, there is, and I'm going to, the main thing, the biggest thing about this whole sovereignty thing is that there is a common law which basically states that you are, that you're not supposed to harm someone, you're not supposed to cause harm to someone, cause harm to their property, lie, cheat, steal, basically the golden rule. Do unto others as you would have do unto them. Do not commit fraud in your contracts. As I said, basically it's the common law. There is no act or statute that says that, for example, there's no act or statute that says that I can't smoke marijuana. You know, like those acts or statutes apply to what is called a person. Now, a person, as we see it, is a fictional corporate entity. It's not a real human being. I consider myself to be a human being, and all the acts and statutes that apply to persons
don't apply to you.
They don't apply to me.
Well, Curtis, let me ask you this. You know, I'm curious as to how you go about your day-to-day life as not a person, but a human being. I mean, do you have to drive on the roads that are paid for by other taxpayers and that are built by the government?
Well, when it comes to driving, I don't really drive. I never really have. That's more
of a... Do you walk on a sidewalk that was built by the government?
Well, sidewalks are public property, you know, like they belong to everyone.
Yeah, but it's public because somebody has to pay for it in order to lay the concrete down on the ground.
Well, the thing is, everything's been paid for. That's the thing that most people don't understand about this, is that, and in about society in general.
But who has it been paid for by?
It has been paid for by your government. It has been paid for, like, okay.
But tell me this, has it not been paid for by other people, by taxpayers? So, you know, I mean, I think that it's a fair question to ask whether you're perhaps taking advantage of other people that actually do pay.
I understand what you're saying. I'm not taking advantage of anybody is the way I see it. The thing is, you have, this is all going to be edited, right?
No, this will not be edited. This is the interview. Well,
okay, well, whatever. Doesn't matter. I'm just curious because I didn't really have any real chance. I've been really busy the last couple of days.
Yeah, but I just want you to explain, you know, your lifestyle, your ideology to us and how it is that you go about day-to-day life living in civilization but not wanting to necessarily be a part of it.
Well, the thing is, as I said, everything has been paid for. When you pay taxes, your tax money isn't going to infrastructure. It is going to a debt that has been incurred by our governments for the last who knows how long, right? Okay, 70 years.
So where does the money come from for the infrastructure?
That money? Well, I couldn't tell you exactly, but I'll tell you that...
Well, it was paid for by somebody a while ago. Curtis, I want to move on very quickly because I want to ask you a question. You know, I know that you're in Canada, but the Southern Poverty Law Center here in the U.S. recently wrote an entire report about sovereign citizens. They said that now in the U.S. they have amassed to about 300,000 people, but they essentially painted sovereign citizens as dangerous people. They mentioned two men, a father and son team, that murdered two police officers. They did an entire profile of some of the leaders. And, you know, how does that make you feel to have them label this group of people as a danger, perhaps a threat to society?
I would say that anyone who labels sovereign citizens as a broad group like that, as dangerous or extremist, I would say that that is ignorant and uneducated. They obviously haven't researched into what sovereignty is. They obviously don't know what we're all about. Like, I'm a
hello, everybody out there, YouTubers and all that. It's Alan Nelson of the Beaujolais family here again. It's I'm going to start dating these things so that we can keep track. It's February 9th, 2012, at approximately 11:48. Okay, I was looking through some videos on YouTube, and that's what prompted me to make this video. I seen this one. It said, what did it say? Something about propaganda war against the sovereign citizen movement. Okay, and I've heard this term several times. People using this term, and a few groups down in the United States and law study groups use it, and I'm. I just gotta say, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and I don't want to sound crass or judgmental or anything, but if you go into court and you call yourself a sovereign citizen, you're going to jail, okay? Or you're gonna, you know, get whatever they're gonna dish out to you, and they're gonna give it to you, okay? Because the judge is gonna look at you like you're an idiot, because the word sovereign citizen, or this phrase sovereign citizen, is an oxymoron, okay? And I'm going to prove it to you here, because I know this is only like my third video on YouTube, and you guys don't know who I am, and I could be just some idiot on the internet myself, okay? So it's going to be real easy to prove this to you guys, and I really wish you guys would stop using the phrase, because it's really making the rest of us that are studying the law and call ourselves sovereign look like fools. You guys are making us look like idiots, because you're going around calling yourself sovereign citizens. It's an oxymoron. You can't... A citizen, okay, look here, under Bouvier's Law Dictionary on the internet here is where I usually look under my law references. It's www.constitution.org/bouvier_c.htm. Okay, I'd show you the screen, but then I'd have to turn the phone around, and it's mirrored because it's my phone, and it's weird. Okay? So, I'll just read it for you. Citizen. First thing. The very first thing right off the hop. Persons. Okay? It makes it very clear. Persons. Period. Citizen, comma, persons, period. Okay? Then it goes on to say, one who, comma, under the Constitution and laws of the United States. Well, we know that it's, you know, other countries use citizen as their membership term as well. Okay? So basically, you're under the laws of your certain country. You're under their laws. Okay? And before I digress, we'll go on about the word country in another video, okay? Because it's not a country. These people are making you believe it's a country, and If you look up the definition of country, that's what it should be, but it's not. It's a corporation. Okay? So, but I digress from the topic of this video. Okay, so that's the citizen. Now, if you go to sovereign, okay, you'll see it says it's the chief ruler, the one who makes the laws. Okay? And if you... The definition of sovereign is a little bit more deep than that. There's actually been papers written on it. And sovereign is basically from where the law is derived. Technically, the sovereign is God. Okay, if you believe in God, God is your sovereign. Okay, but we, as men, created by God, are also sovereign in our own body, mind, and spirit. Okay? Now, we know this because we have free will. It's just that simple. It's basic stuff. Okay? We've got free will, so we're sovereign. We were born in America, and we have free will, and everybody's a king and queen over here. Okay? We were born free. Okay, we've got the free will to choose, you know, our destiny over here. Okay, it says it right in their corporate charters. They have to let us, you know, happiness thing and the security of our person. Okay, all right. So, I digress again. Let's go on to. Another definition here. It's kind of a difficult one to say. It's got some big words in there, and I'm not a very good out loud reader here. Let me see if I can sum it up for you. No, I just typed this in the dictionary.com. Okay, oxymoron, a figure of speech by which locution produces an incongruous, seemingly self-contradictory effect. Okay? So that's what you've got there. Right? Sovereign, meaning one who governs himself. Right? And citizen, meaning one who is governed. Okay? So, I imagine when you go around calling yourself sovereign citizens, you don't get too much respect from the law enforcement, I bet. Huh? Because they're looking at you like you're an idiot. You don't know the law. You don't know what you're talking about, and you're a ward of the state. You are a citizen. You are a citizen. Okay? Sorry to break it to you.
When it comes to student loans, sometimes things are a little bit tricky. You have to understand that you cannot discharge a student loan through bankruptcy. This contract has to be canceled. We have some special documentation specifically designed for getting rid of the student loan and also dealing with the child support. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, and if you have a child support situation or if you have a student loan, you want to access the Get Rid of the Student Loan package. It is designed for dealing with both of them. Along with that package comes Tahaka Archives Master Library. So you'll be thoroughly equipped to deal with this situation and go on to deal with other situations that may be occurring in your life. The bottom line is to detach yourself from these income-sapping situations that you have been put into by Rome. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, access to get rid of the student loan package. That is a major problem that's going on inside the United States, and the way to eliminate that problem is located there. When you get to newfreehelpgroup.com, examine that page, click on the link, www.tahakaarchives.org. That'll take you right over there where the packages are. If you click under the little wording under the photograph, a little drop-down menu will come in and give you additional information. However, once you do that, if you decide to do that, give me a call at area code 904 303-903-9061, and we would get with you and give you any other additional information that you would need in dealing with the cancellation of the contract on your student loan. Okay? All right.
Hi, guys. I wanted to talk to you about why I believe silver and gold won't protect you in the long term from the economic collapse that's coming. First and foremost, I'd like to say that I do believe that gold and silver are going to go up in price. And if you have a bunch of cash, you'd be better off putting in gold and silver than keeping it in cash or in paper investments of any sort. But I've always consistently recommended that people get land instead if they have enough money to be buying a significant amount of investments of any sort. So that's been my position, and I stick to my position, and I'm living my position. This is my hedge against what's coming right here. This is what we put our money into. And, this is what we believe enough to do it. So the people who are going to get mad, I know some people are going to get mad about this. People are going to get mad because for some reason it threatens them, or, you know, they take it personally when someone starts talking about the price of a metal. In my opinion, when that happens, when people are taking it personally and getting angry about one person's opinion about the value of a metal, then it ceases to be just an investment strategy. It's become a religion. So why would I say that it's not going to protect you from the economic collapse? Because this economic collapse is not going to be a short-term thing. It's going to be a total shift in our way of life. And I've said that over and over again for people who've been subscribed to my channel, but for some people it takes a while to sink in, the reality of it. Now, when the U.S. loses its world reserve currency status, when it ceases to be the petrodollar, when we cease to have the power that we do that's based simply on the fact that people have to have the dollar in order to buy oil, a lot of things are going to change in this country. Right now we're a 70% consumer-based economy. We don't produce enough to be a wealthy nation on our own right. We are living off of a very particular political and economic empire strategy that will not work once that's gone. It just won't. It's going to be different. And it's very likely the United States will be a third world country for some time. I don't think it's going to be short. I don't think it's going to be 2 or 3 years. I think it's going to be 5, 6, 7, 8, maybe 20 years before we snap out of it. Because snapping out of it is not a question of just getting jobs. It's a question of completely rebuilding our manufacturing base. That's not something that's going to happen over a few years. It's going to take a very, very, very long time. And there's no guarantee that we'll ever come back to the current status. There's a lot of countries that have risen to empire status who never came back. They disappeared off the face of the earth. And, we have no guarantee of ever snapping back. And you need to look at what will enable you to thrive in a third world country type situation. And I always bring this back to my point of reference because I've lived in third world countries. And the key to doing well in an impoverished nation is to have a means of production. Gold and silver is not a means of production unless you're the miner. If you're a miner, well, hey, good for you, man. That's the means of production. Buying gold and silver with money that you earned working at a restaurant, or buying gold and silver with money that you earned working at a movie theater, or any kind of job that is not going to be there once the consumer-based economy collapses, is not a survival strategy. It's not. You're going to have to be looking at what people are going to absolutely need that they're not going to be able to let go of after the manure hits the fan. And one thing that never goes away is food. People need food. And that's why we chose to get farmable land. You know, that's still not a guarantee. I'll be the first to acknowledge that. Just because I have farmable land doesn't mean that we'll be a successful farming family. It's hard. There's a lot of things that can totally knock you down. I mean, right now we're up against a drought and, you know, a pest problem. And those kinds of problems in a post-collapse situation can be life-threatening. So you need to even diversify beyond just a single survival stream, a single production mechanism. But if you don't have any production mechanism, then you do not have a plan, in my opinion. Just having some savings is a hedge in addition to a production means. And I think people who are looking at silver and gold as their primary protection are really missing that. And it's going to be a rude awakening, because when the rest of the economy starts collapsing, when it really starts collapsing and there's no jobs, and those jobs don't come back for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, all of your silver and gold is going to evaporate because you're going to have to spend it. And if you don't have something that's absolutely necessary to everyone else around you in order to get back into this new economy, then you're going to have problems. And this is my opinion on it. This is what I really, really believe. And I believe this economy is going to collapse. And this is where we put every penny that we have. And to the people who say, am I jealous of people who bought silver? That's ludicrous. You know, this. You have to put your money where your mouth is. You have to put your investments where you really believe it's going to count. You know, I could be wrong, but this is where I'm betting my life and my family's life. So you can take that for what it is, but I'm not just saying it because I want to impress you or anything like that. It's just, this is what I really believe. Hope you can take that for what it is, and have a good day. Bye.
Hi there. My name's Terry Ingram, and I just published my new ebook called Police State, 10 Secrets the Police Don't Want You to Know, and How to Survive Police Encounters. In my book, I reveal what goes on inside the mind of the modern-day police officer. You can forget about the mainstream mottos like serve and protect, community service, and other boilerplate mantras spoon-fed to the public by law enforcement, public relation pundits. The policeman is definitely no longer your friend. He's your opponent. Just like the salesman who hones his skills to close the deal, the police officer is a dangerous and practiced adversary to anyone who stands in the way of the police state. Now, I understand that many police officers go into their chosen field with good intentions. However, after intense paramilitary indoctrination, they're soon turned away from the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Those that won't be turned find themselves back on the street. Most police departments have a one-year probationary period, in which time even the best of them are weeded out or discarded. The new breed, that's what they called us when I attended the first academy in South Florida back in 1974. Prior to this, a police officer would simply be hired and a training officer would train him. I attended the very first structurally formal police academy in the state of Florida. The idea was to militarize the up-and-coming police officers and indoctrinate them into a boot camp of sorts. I still occasionally travel by the police academy in Davie in South Florida, and I see the police inductees, I call them, out there standing at attention, saluting, assuming a prone position, and giving the instructor 50 push-ups on command. It makes me want to puke. My book's a must-read for anyone who's confronting any type of police encounter in today's police state. It's imperative that you learn your rights, because that's the only way that we're going to stop them. Whether in your car or your home or out in the community, They're always there, always watching, always listening, and waiting. They are the sharks in the water, and we're the bloody bait. I think you'll find my book informative and also a necessary guide to surviving police encounters in today's police state. If you like it, I'd appreciate it if you support me and purchase a copy. And I thank you very much for your time.
Salad greens and fish go very well together. And they grow very well together, too. Arugula, watercress, and yellow perch are growing together in greenhouses on a busy street in Milwaukee. It's a promising experiment at a place called Growing Power. The community-based urban farm grows food for local groceries and restaurants. Those markets have been hungry for yellow perch since numbers of the favorite fish crashed in Lake Michigan in the 1990s. Will Allen runs Growing Power.
You get two products in a pretty confined system. If you look at that system, you got food growing up there, and you got food growing on the next level, and down in the bottom you got 10,000, probably more like 9,000 now, but about 9,000 perch. We use the plants to filter out the waste.
Plants, soil, and pebbles make natural filters.
Got fish on the bottom, you pump water up and let it matriculate through there and cleanse them back into the system down below.
Allen is refining the process with technical help from Fred Binkowski, an aquaculture specialist at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute.
3,000 pounds of market size fish.
You know, the greenhouse model is fairly unique for aquaculture. Not many people have been doing this.
In many recirculating aquaculture systems, the water is cleaned with expensive mechanical filters and other equipment. At Growing Power, the plants perform the crucial task.
Getting rid of the solids, getting rid of the ammonia, getting rid of carbon dioxide.
Raising fish in cities offers many advantages, according to Binkowski.
You're creating a product that you're really putting at the center of consumer demand. And as a result of that, you're probably reducing transportation costs significantly. You're creating jobs, you know, establishing businesses, creating jobs in the city area. Abandoned factories, you know, with the loss of our manufacturing base here in the north central region. And these are opportunities to get these buildings back up and running again.
That's just 7 inches.
Will Allen sees the benefits of greenhouse aquaculture extending far beyond his particular Milwaukee neighborhood.
We've taken this project into systems that can be replicated easily around the world, because we have people coming in here from around the world, and they see these systems, and they say, I want this in my community, in my small community. So we go into Ghana, we go into South America, into Peru, Colombia, and Argentina. They want this system.
What we can provide through the Sea Grant Outreach Program is all of the state-of-the-art technology for raising yellow perch.
It really meant a lot to have this partnership. Like Fred said, it really offered, to me, an opportunity for the university institute to go into the community and do a community project with a community-based organization. I think that is probably the most powerful thing that I've leveraged around the country when I go around the country and talk about our relationship.
When you're dealing with a student loan situation, that's kind of tricky. You cannot discharge a student loan through bankruptcy. And what we recommend, most of us regard the Internal Revenue Service as a monster. But if you deal with them correctly and put them in a position where they are forced to deal with the circumstances by law, your chances of winning against them becomes 99.9, maybe 100%, if you do it right. Inside the United States, it operates on a continuous series of contracts under the terms of contract law. You never get angry, you don't raise your voice, you don't need to make any threats, but you simply supply them with information regarding the problem that they are having with you and put them in a position where they have to answer your questions by law. It's
okay, Morris, we come to the end of the broadcast, and we're having our brother Sundiata with us in the near future, where we'll actually deal with the construction of where you're going to put your money at. And as you learned by now, the best place to put it for the most cheap investment right now against the backdrop of what's going on inside the United States and the rest of the world is in agriculture. That's the number one thing. That has a twofold thing. You feed yourself, and you can also make a profit, and it's something that everybody needs and everybody wants and everybody cannot do without. So that's the bottom line on investment. I would like to say I thank you all for coming out this evening. I've been your host, Tahaka Mana El Bay, and until next time, you all have a good night. Okay? Good night, Moe.